Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, 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 jokey time. And it's also the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is off this week. He is celebrating his birthday, so he's taking the weekend off. So it'll just be me and Steve Procopi doing the movie reviews, and that'll be coming up in just a few minutes. So that's coming up. Also, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us for talk or text. All of that cool stuff. We're going to be talking about some stories behind the scenes of music songs, a little behind-the-scenes stories on how some of these songs were made and some secrets behind them. We're also going to talk about some American movies that were shot in each state, the most American movies shot in each state, and so much more. So our phone number is 312-981-7200. That's the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. So there you go. And also, download our podcast. Subscribe to our podcasts. Every single second of the show is always podcast, and it's free, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. You subscribe, it'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. For our podcasts. And we have a lot of people who listen to our podcast. We appreciate that very much. And so there you go. All right. It is a Monday morning. So we're starting off our week here, as we always do. My dad will be telling a joke and all that cool stuff. And we'll get to the movie reviews in just a few minutes. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And for talk and text. All right. Let's say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Howdy, howdy.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah?
Good. Very good.
You have a good weekend?
Yeah. Watched a lot of Masters of Horror.
Ah, yes.
Getting into some of those. Dreams in the Witch House. Wow.
Yeah, huh?
That one really, that did a number on me.
Did it really?
Yeah, it was, something really got me about it. But, you know, I always love it when Stuart Gordon does H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, yeah. He's nuts. He's nuts. That's the whole first season of Masters of Horror. It's the show that I missed that show. I wish it was still on. It was on Showtime, and it was just each episode was a different horror filmmaker, you know, pretty legendary, and they got a lot of the big names to get out there and make some of those great movies. But yeah, it's pretty cool. All right, let's go into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you?
Doing very well. Rested up. Ready to go.
Ready to go. You were up in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I spent most of the weekend up in Milwaukee.
How
went
was
to
that?
Summerfest. And of course, Steve Earle. I spoke with you about that already. But
yeah.
And then Friday. Yeah, I mean, it was really just all about family. Spending time with Jeannie's family this weekend. It was a lot of fun.
That's
also
cool.
Did some sightseeing around. Kind of, she toured me around where she's from, and so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm a fan.
It's beautiful up there.
I'm a fan of Milwaukee.
Yeah, Milwaukee's really nice, man.
Yeah, it's really, really cool.
They've done a really nice job making that downtown area enjoyable. You
yeah.
know, good place to go spend a little money.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been up there.
It's probably changed quite a bit.
Yeah,
nice there.
Yeah, it's very cool. And then you know, the Summerfest is always a blast.
Yeah, like I said, got rained out, but the time we had, yeah. Oof. Yeah, I wish we would have went, we went Thursday. Friday was nice, man. The people that had Friday tickets, they stayed dry, but
yeah,
not the same luck Thursday.
Okay. All right, well, you're back. And we'll again as we know now, every Friday at 3:30 a.m. Vic shares with us his what's going on in the music world, your Vic's picks. And
now, this Friday we
are not on this
right.
Friday. Right. I'm off on Friday. I'm taking the 4th off, and then I'm taking the 5th off as well. We'll do it the following week for sure.
Yeah.
We'll get back into it. And you're going out of town, right? Soon, Vic?
Yeah, I work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, another short week for me, and then I'll be flying. Oh, actually no, not flying. We're doing a road trip. That would kill the purpose of the whole trip if we flew there.
Where are you going?
I can't say because the kids don't know yet. In fact, we have not told anyone in our family, so nobody knows. It's a surprise.
Wow.
So,
Wow.
I think they're going to Disney World.
Oh, man. No.
Wow. All right. Okay. A little surprise. Keeping the surprise going.
Yeah, I think it's my first road trip with the kids, and they're older now, so they'll remember this one, so we wanted it to be a surprise.
Oh, okay.
Right, should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. That's cool. Did you guys go to the Pride Parade?
Well, it starts right by my house.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm down the block, so I got to see a little bit of it before that storm rolled in.
Yeah.
It was nasty.
Yeah. Everybody was safe, though. They as Vic reported in the news.
I've had to contact ABC News in New York because they sent out a message nationwide saying that Chicago's Pride Parade was canceled to the storms.
It wasn't.
No, but they sent the email out nationwide.
It was shortened.
Yeah.
But it wasn't canceled. You can't cancel Pride Parade in Chicago.
No.
I couldn't believe it.
That's not going to happen. Are you nuts?
It would be replaced by a riot.
Yeah. No way. So, going to be hot this week again. I hate this weather. I hate it. Mm. I had to buy a dehumidifier.
Really?
Yeah, because my toilet tank is sweating. I'm not kidding. My toilet tank is like dripping. It's wet. So I got a dehumidifier that I'm going to put in the bathroom.
Oh, there's
because of the heat.
The last thing you need is a sweaty toilet.
Yeah. That was my radio name when I was in college. You need a sweaty toilet! But it's common. You know, it's just it's humid and warm in my apartment, so I got the little dehumidifier that I'm going to put in the bathroom, and that should make everything okay. But that's always a lot of, you know.
Well, it's going to ruin my daily outfit. I almost exclusively wear black jeans every day because I'm not a big fan of shorts.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I'm going to do here.
Well, you're just going to have to sweat.
Yeah. Just
black jeans.
Yeah. I usually just wear black jeans and a.
What are you, Johnny Cash? What?
Maybe I am.
Wow. All right. Vic, do you only wear black jeans?
I do kind of prefer darker clothes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I own a pair of black jeans. I need a pair of black jeans.
I do have a pair of black jeans. I don't wear them all the time, though. So I'm wearing shorts right now because it's 90 degrees outside.
I'm not a big fan of shorts either, Tom, but I wear them just because I can't stand the heat.
Yeah.
But I'm not a big fan of them either.
I wear them because it's warm out. You know? So I don't, you know. I don't really have a particular opinion about shorts. I think they're fine. And, you know, when it's this kind of weather, man, you gotta be comfortable. That's all you gotta do is you gotta be trying to be comfortable. So, it's miserable. These kind of weather is miserable. It's always like 100 degrees close to my birthday. The weather is always unpleasant on my birthday. So
that's why I'm lucky to be born in the fall. It's the perfect temperature.
You were born in November?
Yeah, I'm in November. So sometimes it's bad. There have been years where it's a little bit chilly, but most of the time it's just, right in the middle.
Is it? Now, Vic, you were born in November too, right?
Mm, yep.
Yeah, Scorpio over here, if you subscribe to that sort of thing.
I've been told every time I say, yep, November, Scorpion, mm-hmm, yeah. They look at you that way. Well, what?
I married two of them. I married two Scorpios.
Pieces of work.
Worked out real well. Actually, you know that we're supposed to get along. Like if you look into the sistrology nonsense, Cancer and Scorpio are they should get along very well. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But
I guess the stars didn't align.
No.
No.
No. Twice.
Mm.
So I don't know. All right. So we got movies to review here. Not a bunch, and Eric is off this week. So it'll be the movie reviews will be a little shorter than they usually are. Only a couple of movies really to get to. And Steve Procopi is going to join us. Steve, by the way, is he works over at the Music Box Theater, and they do great stuff over there at the Music Box. And we'll talk a little bit about that, too, plus review all the new movies. And again, our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And again, follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And, of course, Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, let's take a break. Come back. We've got the movie reviews. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're also going to talk about the most American movies from every state that take place in every state. And we got some secret backstories to some songs that we're going to get to as well. Lots of other stuff, too. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. And, talk and text. And, that's what's coming up on the show. It is Monday morning, and that means we have the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, who is off this week, it's his birthday this weekend, so he's taking off this weekend. And Steve Procopi joined me every week to talk about the new movies, and it's just going to be me and Steve this morning to review the new films. And let's welcome Steve to the show. Welcome back, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
All right, man, how are you?
Good.
Okay, let's start off. Why don't you start off? Tell us about The Raft.
Oh, my. Okay, this is a... there are actually two really fascinating, very different documentaries coming out right on top of each other this month, and they're both about sailing. And the first one is called The Raft. The second one's called Maiden. It comes out in like 2 weeks, and we're definitely going to talk about that. But the first to arrive is from a director named Marcus Linden. I believe it's a Swedish production, technically, although most of it's in English. And it's called The Raft, and it concerns a 1973 science experiment set on the Atlantic Ocean that resulted in some very unexpected and perhaps unwanted conclusions about human behavior. And it was the brainchild of this Spanish anthropologist named Santiago, and it was called the Akali experiment. And he basically put together this crew of five men and six women, very deliberately, almost cast, very attractive, young, fit, full of hormones, from various countries and religious backgrounds, and he sort of set up this environment, and they put them all on a raft and it's basically sail across the Atlantic to Mexico and just see what happens. Except he didn't just see what happens, he kind of instigates things and manipulates things. And he was trying to figure out what the nature of war and where conflict comes from and how people solve problems or create problems. And so ultimately, you know, it's a 100-day journey. And what he thought was going to happen was that maybe violence would erupt or there'd be a lot of sexual pairings, which there were to a certain degree. But what ends up being the result of this is that everyone kind of figures things out and gets along, and he ends up being the enemy. He ends up being the person that they revolt against, almost to the point where some of them actually consider pushing him over the side of the boat. And this is a documentary, mind you. This is all very well filmed. I mean, it's like very well well filmed, as in the guy was great about capturing everything on film, taking notes, doing journals. And it's just, it's a weird emotional roller coaster about a guy who is supposed to be sort of an observer and ends up being like the biggest instigator, and like I said, a master, like a manipulative bastard. And he, you know, he did things like put the women in charge of the most important tasks, including making one of them the captain, while making the men do sort of the menial tasks and sort of changing things up that way. He starts fights and starts like these conflicts. It's almost, today this would absolutely be a reality show. There's no doubt in my mind. But at the time he was supposed to be a science experiment, and if something didn't come out of this, he was going to lose face in the scientific community. So that's why he was pushing to have results happen. But what's really interesting, I mean, the relevance, like, why is this important today? I mean, the relevance today seems pretty obvious, that, like, we live in a time where it seems everyone is ready to come to blows over things. And what it's fascinating to watch is how these people sort of bonded around hating this guy. And it's a complete emotional roller coaster. It's fascinating to watch human behavior, and I love that the footage isn't just sort of pretty pictures of these good looking people getting very tan on a boat. It's they actually illustrate some of the behaviors that sometimes the scientist is trying to prove, but also how they turned against him. It's a fascinating journey, both the film today. There's interviews with quite a few of the people who were on that journey. All the women are interviewed in the film, and one of the men, I believe the anthropologist is no longer living, but and they actually interview them on a life-size replica of the raft, which seems like they're just trying to push buttons. But so in a way, the filmmakers are also instigating things. But I love this movie. It's a total blast. It's a sort of a lost chapter in history. I don't know if the results of this experiment ever amounted to anything, but at least we get this movie, which is completely worth watching. And I believe it's only playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center. So.
Okay. Well, it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's tremendous.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Steve, tell us about Annabelle Comes Home.
Oh my, we're jumping right in, huh?
Yeah, okay. Jump right into that one.
All right, good. The one thing that I think becomes abundantly clear after watching the sort of third story in the Annabelle series is that the closer these films align themselves to the original Conjuring movies, of which they are spin-offs of, and specifically the Warrens, who are played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, the better they actually are. And in my estimation, the Conjuring films are kind of set a new bar for modern ghost stories. I was very excited to see that the Warrens were very much a presence in Annabelle Comes Home, because I think it makes it a better movie. And the film starts out with them actually taking possession of the doll, and immediately, you know, just to drive home, they notice that something is up with this doll, and it seems to be aggravating anywhere that they're driving that there happen to be spirits. They drive by an accident, and the person who has just died seems really upset and is plaguing Lorraine. They're parked near a cemetery, and those ghosts don't seem happy about Annabelle being around. They're in the film in the beginning and a little bit at the end, but they're in it enough to make it, to me, sort of like a Conjuring 2.5. They, aside from this little prologue where almost the entire film takes place in the walls of the Warren's household, and they have brought Annabelle there. They put her in this room where all these relics and artifacts are that are all cursed or haunted or possessed or whatever. They put her in that glass case that we all know. They have a priest seal the case as well as the room, and apparently, according to Mitt, they had that room sealed by a priest every month. So then we move on to sort of dealing with their 10-year-old daughter named Judy, who's played by McKenna Grace, who a lot of people have seen play both a young Tanya Harding and I, Tanya, as well as a young Carol Danvers in Captain Marvel. And she is really like sort of the linchpin of this whole thing. What's interesting about Judy is that she's sort of grown up around these spooky things, so they don't really bother her that much. But at the same time, like at school, she's sort of isolated because kids are a little freaked out by her, or more specifically, specifically their parents are freaked out by her. And so she's a little bit of a loner, which is why she sort of latches on to a babysitter character named Mary Ellen, who's played by Madison Iceman. And when Mary Ellen's best friend Daniela finds out that she is babysitting for the Warrens, she gets very excited because she knows what they are. And so the Warrens leave, and suddenly we're all in the house. And this thing's, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. The babysitter's friend, we think she's just sort of a troublemaker party girl, but it turns out she actually has a little bit vested in the spirit world as well. And it actually sort of, that brings about some emotional, relevance that was a little surprising. And I really like that. There are no throwaway characters in this movie, which I also liked. But basically she goes into the room to mess with the doll, and she touches and activates every single thing in that room. So the movie becomes like this amazing spook house, like greatest hits. My favorite thing about the movie is that it is relentless. It barely gives you time to breathe between getting scared by different things, because every corner that you turn, there's something new that has been set free in this house. And it really, to me, it just scared the bejesus out of me, and I loved it. And the director, I believe it's the first time he's directed a feature. His name is Gary Dauberman, but he has written or co-written all of the Annabelle films as well as The Nun. And I think he also did part of the two It movies that are coming out right now. And he has a real sense of what makes things about the doll scary, about just things in general scary. There's a great layered performance there by McKenna Grace that really kind of just roots everything. And above all else, it makes me very excited for the next Conjuring movie, which just started shooting a few weeks ago. So yes, very highly recommended by me.
Okay. Hang on, Steve.
Yes.
All right. Steve Procopio is going to hang out here. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Annabelle Comes Home. And then we've got a couple more movies to review as well on this Monday morning. All right. Take a quick break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because that's what he does. It's a jokey time. And we've got a lot more that we're going to be talking about, too, right here on 720 WGN. Right now, though, Eric Childress has the weekend off, so he'll be back next week to review the new movies. But Steve Procopio is with us, and before the break, he told us about Annabelle Comes Home, and he liked it very much. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like this movie a lot more than I thought I would. I'm not a huge Conjuring guy. I thought the first one was good, but I've been kind of on the fence with the other ones, and the other Annabelle movies just didn't do it for me. But this one is really scary. It's really effective, and I didn't think it was going to be, and I think this guy made a really terrific film debut as a director, because he really tightens the screws. It's really good, and there's a lot of scary stuff in it. And you're right, it is like sort of this funhouse of horror that gets unleashed. And this kid is really good. It's a great performance by the main kid. And there's a lot of scary stuff in it. And I just got to say that this was a lot better than I thought it was going to be, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not a huge Conjuring guy.
Yeah.
But this one fits into that, into the category. And I think people are going to be freaked out by it. And it made $20 million over the weekend, which is solid, I guess. $31 million total.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a solid number. I don't know how much how much better that is than the other Annabelle movies or the Conjuring films, but these movies do pretty good. They do good business.
I think most of them do. I mean, it's almost, you could be cynical about it and see that the reason they unleash all of these things that are in that room is to see which ones land with the audience for, like, future.
Yeah.
Future films, which I could definitely see a couple of these getting in that, going down that path. But, I mean, whatever. Just give me that Conjuring movie, that Conjuring 3 first, and I'll put up with whatever nonsense they want to do after that.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, they're shooting the Conjuring movie right now, as you said.
Yep.
So that'll probably be, what would it be out next year then?
I believe it's September 2020, yes.
September 2020. Okay. Yeah. Well, they're continuing. The movies are going to continue. Okay. Mm-hmm. Steve, tell us about Framing John DeLorean.
This is a really fascinating, again, mostly documentary. I guess they're calling it a hybrid documentary about the famed car maker and car executive John DeLorean. To some, he was this visionary who revolutionized the automobile industry, first at GM and then starting his own car company. And to others, he was the ultimate con man. He was a drug dealer, or a would-be drug dealer, I guess, amateur drug dealer, who got caught basically in his first drug deal on camera. And granted, he was allegedly trying to save his failing car company, but still. So anyway, like I said, this is a hybrid documentary that combines an incredible amount of really interesting archival footage and photos, as well as new interviews with his associates and employees and family members, adversaries, certainly. And then there are these interesting dramatic reenactments of some key events, and we have that are done, or probably the thing people are focusing on the most, because it's Alec Baldwin is playing DeLorean. Morena Baccarin is playing Christine Ferrara, his supermodel wife. Josh Charles is playing Bill Collins, who's sort of the co-founder and co-inventor of DeLorean cars. And those are really interesting, but they're also interviewing the actors as they're sort of getting ready to play these parts, to just sort of find out what they've learned about this character, about this person, and how they're trying to play it, and how they're approaching playing these characters. And it becomes very meta, but it's also really fascinating to just watch that process. And I should tell you that Alec Baldwin's makeup is amazing, and it's done by the same SNL makeup team that does his Donald Trump look. And so it really, you get a lot of that, of him getting that makeup put on. And there's a lot of references to DeLorean as sort of this Icarus character flying too close to the sun, and we get a little lost in the mythology. But it is fascinating to watch this journey of a man who absolutely committed crimes and hurt lots of people, but is still sort of looked at with some sort of reverence. And the co-directors, Don Argent and Sheena Joyce, do a really good job laying out the real story, separating sort of the myth from facts. There's a lot of things I thought I knew, especially about his drug case, that were not true at all. And it's sort of one of the toughest things to do, is to sort of get everything lined up and straight. And they do a great job explaining some very difficult scenarios, especially in the business world. But I mean, basically what it comes down to is John DeLorean kind of wrote the book on being the modern day shady business owner, not necessarily criminal business owner, but yeah, it's a really cool little thing, cool little movie. And there's, of course, they get into after a couple years after he got busted in this drug deal, is when Back to the Future came out, and somebody makes the point that if he had just been able to hold on a couple years more, he would have been like this Cinderella story, and the car's sales would have taken off like to such an amount that, I mean, Bob Gale is interviewed in the film and basically makes that point too, the writer of Back to the Future. And but yeah, he probably would have had a very different life if he'd been able to just sort of stay on the straight and narrow, and not try to, you know, sell a bunch of cocaine for millions of dollars and keep his company afloat. The interviews with his former partner, Bill Collins, as well as his two grown kids, his son and daughter, are probably the most devastating and haunting, and their stories really do show the collateral damage of the DeLorean story. And they do a great job of, like I said, never letting us forget that he really did hurt a lot of people. And he, you know, he screwed everybody both in business and in life. And yet he is still, to a certain degree, celebrated as a guy that made his dream come true for a fleeting moment. And, you know, if people find inspiration in that to this day, I guess more power to them. But yeah, it's a really, really interesting thing. And I think it's one of the better documentaries I've seen this year, too.
It's a fascinating way that they're telling the story. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like with the reenactments and everything. Mm-hmm. And it comes off smoothly.
Yeah, I mean it's actually inserted quite nicely into things, but at the same time they're not trying to make it seamless. Because they keep interrupting it. I get it. It shouldn't work. When I was thinking about it, like this shouldn't work, but it's really beautifully pieced together. I got to say, I got to give them credit because what they're trying to do is not just tell the story, but get a little inside what might make these people, all of the key players, tick. Certainly DeLorean and his wife, but whose career was just leveled as a result of basically being married to him.
Yeah.
But she was like the top supermodel when they got married. And she's still alive, but she's not interviewed in this movie. She didn't want to have anything to do with this movie, but her kids are in it and they have a lot to say. So,
yeah.
Like I said, it doesn't sound like any of this should function as a straightforward documentary, and it's not a straightforward documentary, but it is a really interesting story, and I like the approach. Just if for no other reason, it's different,
yeah.
and not clunky or anything like that.
Where's it playing?
I think it's only open at the Music Box, and it's just a very specific time. It's not like a full run because it was sort of added to the calendar at the last minute. So it's like maybe once a day for the week at least.
Okay. All right.
We actually had somebody brought their DeLorean and parked it out front.
Oh, is that right?
And it was a tricked out Back to the Future DeLorean. It was not like a regular one. So I sat outside the theater and just watched every single person walking down the street stop, give a double take, like point at their, like, they're telling their kids, look at that, and pictures. I mean, it was getting dangerous on the street.
Cars
were slowing down. It was hilarious. But it was so fun.
Did it have a flux capacitor in it?
It had the right license plates. It had everything. It was down to the detail. Yeah. And the guy was letting people sit in it and take pictures inside. It was great.
Yeah. You know, we had a few years ago, I mean, last year, my entire film club for 6 months was all
sure.
Zemeckis movies.
Yeah.
I showed Back to the Future, but 2 years earlier I had shown it, and someone showed up with a DeLorean and parked it out in front of the Rosemont theater.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no.
So, I don't know. This was just like a regular DeLorean. He didn't have it tricked out with the flux capacitor and all that stuff.
It's fun to hear Bob Gale talk about why it didn't start out as a DeLorean. It was something else.
Right.
And they changed it because, you know, they literally were promoting the DeLorean as the car of the future. So
yeah,
let's just, you know, and it, yeah, that's a great little piece of the story. It's a very small piece, but it is like a great what if moment in the story. So
right. There you go. Framing John DeLorean is the movie. Mm-hmm. All right, Steve, hang on. Okay. I got one more movie to review, and it's called Yesterday, and we'll do that when we get back right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. There you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and you can also stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Steve Procopi is with us. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, tell us about Yesterday.
Let me just start by saying that when I first saw the trailer for this movie, I thought it was maybe one of the greatest premises that I'd heard in years.
Yeah.
From a terrific writer in Richard Curtis, who did Four Weddings and a Funeral and Love Actually and About Time, and a really talented director that I love dearly, Danny Boyle, Trainspotting, Slumdog Millionaire, you know the movies. And I loved it, I guess, so much that we actually booked it at the Chicago Critics Film Festival sight unseen. Mm. It's one of the only times we've ever done that. I think we've only done it once before. So yesterday centers around a struggling singer-songwriter named Jack Malik, who's played by Hamish Patel. And it's about how he's biking home one night and the whole planet suffers a momentary power outage that somehow leads to him having an accident on his bike, and he bumps his head, and when he wakes up, not only are his front teeth missing, but the world is missing the Beatles. Basically, no one but him seems to know the Beatles were ever a thing, because they weren't, apparently. Thankfully, there's no attempt to explain why this has happened. It just happened. And sort of in an effort to cheer him up after his accident, his friends get him a new guitar, and he just strums the first thing that comes to mind, and it's Yesterday by the Beatles, and they all are like, oh my God, that's an amazing song. And he is completely confounded, and eventually he figures out the situation. And he makes the decision at some point that, I'm not sure it's completely altruistic, but he decides that the best way to become famous, because he's certainly not doing it with his own music, is to take the music of the Beatles and pretend it's his. And he becomes very quickly a huge rock star. And he's sort of taken under the wing of Ed Sheeran, playing himself in this, who he opens for him, then he becomes this huge star. And we find out during the course of the film that other things have sort of vanished from history, like Harry Potter, although that's not really dealt with pretty much, but big things. He has a manager / best friend who's played by Lily James, who also is very much in love with him, although he seems sort of oblivious to it. And they sort of struggle with his stardom as well. I guess there are also these mysterious figures that are sort of lurking around the periphery of Jack's life, who turn out to be something very interesting, although not especially compelling. And perhaps the best moment in the film, and the more I think about it, the more it really hit me, was near the end when Jack takes he takes a trip to a remote sort of seaside location to visit someone. And it seems pretty clear to me that that scene is actually the reason for the film to even exist. And I'm not even sure it pays off, but it's a really great moment. Some people might think it's a little dicey to even be in this, but I actually really liked it. But my feelings on the whole film are very mixed to negative, because there are so many directions this story could have gone that would have been much more interesting. They only sort of tap into a little bit about the repercussions of not having the Beatles' music be a part of the world, culturally or musically or philosophically. I mean, there's a joke in here about Oasis also not existing, and he just sort of says, oh, of course not. But I wanted sort of more, like, take that further. Let's go. Let's figure this out. Like, how much does it really put a dent in the world? And how much does the world lost because of this? And I'm just wondering, like, same with these other things that are missing from the world. Because I feel like Harry Potter missing from the world is a huge deal, too, to a certain degree. So, and I don't even think Ed Sheeran would be a musician or a successful musician without the Beatles. So him even being in this is sort of bizarre. I'm not sure that my ideas would have made it a more interesting movie, but it certainly were the questions I stepped out of this with. I mean, obviously the music is great, and if you just want to hear like 17 Beatles songs done by Patel, then you're going to have a great time. But I will die I will die professing that just because a film has a lot of great music in it, especially Beatles music, doesn't mean it's a great film. So, it comes really close at times to getting it right, but without quite getting there. Certainly more right than, you know, like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Oh God.
But, But yeah, I mean, but at the same time, I was just like, it felt a couple times where it just felt really close to getting and it just missed, I think. And it consistently kept missing for me. So if all you care about is hearing these songs, as people who apparently, all these people who claim to like Bohemian Rhapsody keep telling me that that's, they just want to hear the music, you're going to have a great time. If you want an actual story behind this or reasons, like why, what is the purpose of this film? That's what I kept asking myself. And it just never really gave me that. So I was disappointed.
Yeah, me too. I was really looking forward to this too, because, you know, obviously I love the Beatles and, and as you said, the premise is great. It's a really, really great idea, but they don't explore it enough, and it gets sidetracked with a bunch of other stuff that doesn't necessarily need to be there.
Yeah.
And the logic that is portrayed in the movie sometimes doesn't make any sense at all. Like, you know, with the way the premise is set up, as the movie moves along, and it moves along at a snail's pace too. It just never covers everything that you would want to be covered. There are too many questions. Mm-hmm. I think the cast is really, I mean, they're, you know, really charming and really good.
Yeah.
Hamish Patel is really great. I always love Lily James. I think she's great. but again, they take the logic of this premise and they just kind of flush it down the toilet and don't really do anything with it. You know, look, the songs are great. The songs are always going to be great. There's no question about it. I'm one of the only people on the Across the Universe.
Damn it.
So I back that movie, but I can't back this one, which is odd. I think it's a terrific premise that was wasted. And it doesn't have the sort of urgency that the stylistic urgency that a lot of Danny Boyle stuff has. It seems a little forced at
times. Could have been anyone
absolutely.
Who directed this.
You're absolutely right. There was his stamp is not on it. It just seems like a kind of an afterthought. But to me, it was just it was a waste of a really good premise.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work at all. And at $17 million it made over the weekend, which is not great.
Probably didn't cost that much either.
Yeah.
But I mean, well, actually, I read somewhere that I forget who it was. Some magazine figured out how much it probably cost to license these songs.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
And it was like $10 million, just for the music. And I hope they got a bulk discount because, man, that's crazy.
Yeah. 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 No. I mean, you would think that the licensing alone would be, you know, crazy. There's a box office real quick. Toy Story 4, 57.9 million, bringing its total up to 236 million. still doing very well, and it's a great movie.
I'm going to go see it again this week. Yeah,
as we discussed last week, just a fantastic and the funniest of all the Toy Story movies.
Oh yeah,
Annabelle Comes Home, $20 million, bringing it to a total of $31 million. And again, these movies don't cost a ton of money. And then yesterday, $17 million. Aladdin, God, I can't believe how much money that movie made. $305 million.
Did you ever end up seeing it? Did either of you end up seeing it?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
No, yeah,
I don't remember if you reviewed it. Okay.
No, we were off that week, I think, when it came out, but it's terrible. The Secret Life of Pets, $7 million. That's made significantly less than the first one. Men in Black International, good Lord. $65 million total. Avengers Endgame, back in the top 10 because they re-released it.
But still didn't hit the Avatar
number
yet.
They're not going to hit the Avatar numbers. I know they're very disappointed by that. Child's Play, $23.4 million. That's not doing very well. Rocket Man continuing to make steady money, up to $84 million. And John Wick, Chapter 3, rounds out the top 10, $161 million, $161 million total. Good old Keanu.
I love those movies. He has two movies in the top 10.
Yeah, he does. And they're both great.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both great. Yeah. Yeah, so, all right, next week,
it's a busy week.
It's a busy week.
I mean, not a lot, but like one movie comes out Tuesday, one movie comes out Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all for the holidays, spreading them out among the holidays. We got the next Spider-Man movie, which I've not seen, but I hear good things.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously.
I know what you care about.
Midsummer. I cannot wait to see
whatever
that.
You think that movie's about, I can't wait for you to see it because it's not about that.
Well, you know. Well, the thing that I because obviously the guy who made it, you know, he made Hereditary, which I think is one of the best horror movies of the past 20 years. And I think he made quite an impression with that first film, and I can't wait to see this one. But the thing that's surprising me about the reviews that I've heard is just how funny it is.
It is at times, yeah.
Yeah,
because, I mean, it's nervous laughter, but it is laughter, yeah.
Because Hereditary, not funny.
No.
Not funny.
No.
All right, well...
I should also add for next week, just because I know you might actually care, at the Music Box, we are opening a 4K restoration of Escape from New York.
Whoa!
Yeah, I think it's playing midnights and late. The show's right before midnights.
Oh boy!
And it'll play into the week too. But I know starting the opening weekend, it's playing like at 9:30-ish and midnight.
Yeah,
time. So I will be there for that for sure.
Outstanding. And then also, I know that the following week you guys are showing Mad Max 35.
That's true.
Fury Road. Yeah,
Fury Road. Yeah, yeah.
Very cool. Okay.
Those are midnights too. So yes, that.
Good stuff
Definitely
coming up.
A lot of late night stuff going on.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Steve.
All right.
All right, Steve Procopi will be back with us, and so will Eric Childress to review all the new movies for next week. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And right now, though, we're going to be talking about some songs here that you probably don't know the secret backstories behind them. So we're going to talk a little music here. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200 is the number. So it says here, songs have a way of worming themselves into our brains and lives in subtle ways without us giving a single thought as to how they arrived in our ears. And as it turns out, most songs have really interesting histories. So we asked to come up with some fascinating facts about some well-known songs that you can worm into your brain alongside with the catchy melody. So, Queen's collaboration with David Bowie on Under Pressure was pure impromptu. David Bowie just happened to be by the studio where Queen was recording tracks for their 10th studio album when both parties decided to work on an original piece during a 24-hour session. Mercury and Bowie even did their vocals separately without hearing each other as they sang their part.
So one of the greatest collaborations
of all time.
Ever.
Yeah.
And they're just, let's just hop in the studio.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Because seriously, Under Pressure is one of my favorite songs.
It still gets me every time.
Oh, it's just an unbelievable song.
Just gets you in a certain place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, a friend of mine said that it's the best song by either of those artists.
I don't know about it. It's very good.
It's the best Queen song. It's the best Bowie song. That's what a couple of my friends were saying. But yeah, it's crazy that was, let's just throw this together.
When was the first time you heard Under Pressure?
Oh, I don't know. When it first came out. What is it, 1980?
Yeah, I'd say probably in there.
Yeah. I remember, probably just hearing it on FM, on radio. And, you can't sort of underestimate the impact that song has made.
Mm-hmm. My mom used to have a CD in the car, and it was like the 50 greatest hit singles of the last 50 years. And that was how I got a lot of the biggest songs.
What were some of the ones that were on there?
Bohemian Rhapsody was definitely on there. It was a pretty good compilation, but there was Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Oh, sure.
Is on there. I'm trying to think of some really that was how I heard Bohemian Rhapsody. And it blew my mind. I was like, I didn't know songs could be this long and could tell a story like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a very unusual, record. And again, 6 minutes, over 6 minutes. That wasn't, you didn't hear that. You didn't hear that kind of stuff on pop, on the top 40 radio very often.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't cut it. They didn't, they didn't compromise. And it's obviously a classic.
Mm-hmm.
How about this? Kurt Hammett ganked part of the solo from Enter Sandman from Hart's Magic Man. He says, but I didn't get it from Hart's version, he said, Hammett says. I got it from a cutoff of Ice-T's Power album, where he used it as a sample. The guitarist said that he kept hearing this lick and thought, I have to snake this.
Very Metallica way to put it. Yo, I gotta snake that.
Hart via Ice-T into Metallica.
That's fascinating.
I'm trying to remember what song off of Power, because I haven't listened to that record in a long time, Ice-T's Power. But do we know what part of the solo?
I'm going to see if I can find it right here, because I think I know which one.
What part of the solo was taken from Magic Man?
Magic Man.
By Hart. All right, how about this? The Powerpuff Girls. The theme song is based on a sample from the break in the James Brown song Funky Drummer. Really? I happen to be a really, 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 really big Powerpuff Girls fan. I loved Powerpuff Girls. Yeah, I've got the whole box set on DVD of like every season with all the extras and stuff. Yeah. But I didn't know it was based on a sample from the break in the James Brown song Funky Drummer. Yeah. Good old Powerpuff Girls. You a Powerpuff Girls fan, Tom?
I was huge into the Powerpuff Girls because I was right at the perfect age.
Do you have a favorite?
It's Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup, right?
Yep.
It is Buttercup.
Buttercup, absolutely.
She's the mean one.
Yeah.
She's tough, but she's kind of got a heart of gold.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's my favorite.
Yeah.
Buttercup is my favorite. I mean, I love them all. But Buttercup is my favorite. And you know who did the voice of Buttercup?
No. Oh.
E.G. Daily.
Oh, she was Tommy Pickles as well on the Rugrats.
She's Dottie from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. She does a lot of voice work.
Super prolific.
Yeah, she does a lot of voice work. Animated stuff as well. But yeah, she's also in Valley Girl. You ever see the movie Valley Girl?
I've never seen Valley Girl. What is that one?
Oh, you don't know what Valley Girl is?
No.
Oh, man. Classic. 1983, one of Nicolas Cage's first starring roles. Deborah Foreman is in it. And it's kind of like a new wave version of Romeo and Juliet, where, you know, he's a punker and she's a Valley Girl, and they shouldn't have a romance together. Martha Coolidge directed it. It's a really great movie, if you've never seen it. It's a really, really great movie, and Cage is great in it. Nicolas Cage is great in it.
Well, I'm a big Cage fan.
Well, this is definitely his first big starring role, it was a pretty big cult hit when it came out, and it's gone down as a classic. It's considered a classic now. But yeah, so Valley Girl, and you should check it out.
Yeah,
it's a really
going to add to the long list.
E.G. Daily is in that one too, you know. So that's what we got. That's how we got into the topic there. All right, here's Ike on WGN. Hi, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you know this story about the song "Cold Blood" by Rick James. It was about Linda Blair from The Exorcist because he was going out with her at the time.
Yeah, they dated. I remember that. I remember when they were dating, which is very odd.
It was.
Yeah. Cold blooded. It's about Linda Blair. All right. Hey, thanks, Ike.
No problem.
All right.
All right. I think I found the sample here.
The sample
for the Ice-T.
Okay.
Yeah. So Ice-T sampling Magic Man. So here's the original. This is Magic Man
by Hart. Oh yeah.
So there's that, and then this is where it appears in Ice-T. You must climb out, dig out, fall out, hide from the fallout, because when I get mad, I go all out. I cool it in the coldest cube, dude, and when I'm like a boy, I'm going to get rude.
Okay.
So that made its way to Enter Sandman.
Wow. All right. So we went down to history books for that one. Wow. Enter Sandman. How about this? That out of place chord followed by Sting laughing in the first few seconds of The Police's Roxanne came from the singer's ass. The frontman explained that he hadn't slept the night before recording his vocals and tiredly sat on a piano thinking the lid was closed. But it wasn't. We thought it was funny, so we just left it in. I had no idea that that's that was the story behind that. Yeah, The Police were my favorite band when I was in high school.
Yeah.
They existed. The thing about one of the things I loved about the Police is that their career completely existed while I was in high school. Cuz I went to high school 79 to 83. Their first album came out in 79. Their last album came out in 83. So my entire high school years were dominated by The Police. And I love that band.
A remarkable group.
Yeah.
One of the best, I think, personally, somewhat underrated drummer.
Stuart Copeland's not underrated.
I don't know. I feel like not a lot of people keep him in the conversation.
Man, he's one of the best drummers alive.
Because I go back and I listen to, like, Regatta de Blanc. And there's just some insane stuff he's doing.
No. He's also a really unusual drummer. Yeah.
He puts beats in weird places.
Yeah.
He likes to do that.
Yeah. No, he's I think he's one of the best drummers on the planet, Stuart Copeland. But he also composed some pretty cool music for movies, too.
Yeah.
Like Rumblefish.
Oh, man. What a score.
Oh, man.
And he's played with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra a couple of times. He came over to Tribune Tower once when I first started, and there he was in studio, and it was the first famous person I had seen in the studio in my short amount of time starting working for GN, and I was so nervous I couldn't even talk to him.
Well, I would have been nervous. I had Andy Summers on the show one time.
Oh, wow.
And he had written a book, and he came into town. And, like I just said, the Police were a big band for me. They were they're one of my favorite bands of all time. I love Sting. I love everything about, I love his solo stuff. I just think he's great. And I like Sting much longer than most people. Most people did. I still backed him even when, he was doing silly stuff. But a lot of my friends were like, "How can you still like Sting? What's the matter with you?" So, I remember the when they made that, I call it ass. When it was Sting, Brian Adams, and Rod Stewart.
Adam Stewart and Sting.
Yeah, that's ass. But they did a song for a movie. And was it Robin Hood? No. That was Brian Adams did the song for Robin Hood, which is just horrible. But this was a song. Oh, it was for the Three Musketeers. It was for the Three Musketeers of Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland. And All for One was the name of the song.
Or was it All for Love?
All for Love.
Oh, my God.
And it's Sting, it's Brian Adams, and it's Rod Stewart. And the song is terrible. And on top of that, Sting's wearing a skirt in the video. It's not a kilt. He's wearing a skirt. And I remember someone calling me, one of my friends calling me, he's like, "Put on MTV right now." So I switch MTV on, and there's the video's on. He's like, "You still back this guy? Seriously? You still back this guy?"
Oh, wow. This is quite a very, very of its time. Oh. They're all just kind of standing, singing in the middle of a room.
Yeah.
That's a weird combo.
And the movie was terrible, too. The Three Musketeers. Did you ever see that version?
I did, unfortunately. That was one that I rented from Hollywood Video back in the day, and I was like, "Oh,
that was a mistake."
Yeah, I was like, "Oh wow, it's Three Musketeers. It's gonna be sword fighting, D'Artagnan, all that kind of stuff." Wrong.
The ones from the '70s are great,
mm-hmm.
with Oliver Reed and Michael York.
Those,
definitive as far as I'm concerned.
Oh yeah,
but man, that was. Then they did a Three Musketeers in 3D.
Yeah, that was Paul W.S. Anderson.
God.
You're the other Paul Anderson.
Yeah, the wrong Paul Anderson.
Well, and it was a Paul Anderson because it was W.S. Anderson because Mila Jovovich was in it for no particular reason.
Yeah. She never ages, by the way.
It's
I swear to you, I don't know what she's doing. I don't know what kind of magic pill she's on or something, but she looks exactly the same today as she did in Dazed and Confused. It's exactly the same.
No, I'm guessing that she bathes in the blood of innocence.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can imagine.
She's a lovely woman. All right, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back, and we've got more stories behind some of your favorite pop songs here. And if you got to jump in here with any stories behind the making of songs, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're talking about some of the secret stories behind some songs, some very popular songs. 312-981-7200 if you would like to join us. So there you go. We got some texts that are coming in, 312-981-7200. And 331 area code says, Pat Travers has a song in Valley Girl, When I Tell You That I Love You. Okay. Megan says, yesterday reminds me of Do-Over. It was a WB show where Penn Badgley is the only one who remembers Good Riddance Time of Your Life by Green Day. It came out in 2002. Penn Badgley from Gossip Girl? Don't remember that at all. That was pre-Gossip Girl. So.
And that's a very specific song to be the only one to remember.
Yeah. Yeah, Green Day. Okay. We were talking about the, you know, a while back, we were talking about how some songs are misinterpreted, you know, like that's like people play that like at, you know, weddings and stuff. High school graduations and stuff. And the song is like really sad. it's like people like, oh, time of your life. I remember they played it at the series finale of Seinfeld when they played like old clips and stuff. They played that song. So, how about this? Michael Jackson was Kanye West's biggest inspiration for his album Heartbreaks and 808s. When Kanye played Heartless to Jackson, he complimented him without knowing it was him singing on the track, and that made Kanye way more confident about his singing.
Because he needs more confidence.
Yeah, that's one thing that's lacking in Kanye West, is ego and confidence.
It's got to be sweet, though, to get a compliment from Michael Jackson.
Well, sure. Especially if he's like a hero of yours.
Yeah.
You know? So I forgot, I wanted to mention, I forgot to finish the Andy Summers story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So this was obviously back at the other building, in the Tribune building. And so you remember the Showcase studio, right outside of the Showcase studio was a bathroom. And so Andy Summers was coming in, you know, and so I go to the bathroom, and I'm in the bathroom, and I get out of the bathroom, and I open up the studio door, and there, sitting, like in the guest chair, is Andy Summers, and I was just like, it just didn't even occur to me. So I walk in, and there's Andy Summers sitting there, and I was like, and I was really. You know, I don't get. I've interviewed a lot of celebrities over the years, and you know, I've had the pleasure of working a lot with Roy Leonard when he would have a bunch of celebrities, and so I've got to meet a lot of celebrities.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm normally pretty good about it, but for some reason, I just started freaking out because it was Andy Summers, man, and it was like my whole entire high school years just flashed before me. And he was great. He was on the show. We had him on for an hour. Couldn't have been nicer. And this was, you know, I want to say 2005, maybe 2006 or something like that. And of course, I had to ask him, is there a chance? Because, I mean, you know, they at one point, the three of them hated each other.
Sure.
Well, but they both hated Sting. That was the thing. Stuart and Andy both hated Sting.
Well, when you turn it around and make it Sting and the Police.
Yeah. I mean, but so they you know, then obviously they didn't end on a sweet note or anything.
No.
You know, they just broke up. And so I had to ask him, like the last question I asked him was, is there any chance, is there any chance that you guys can get back together? And then he said, I don't know. You never know. Maybe. And I was like, what? Next year they did a tour.
Yep.
So I saw them on that tour. I feel personally responsible.
Yeah.
For that. I was at Wrigley. Yeah, I went all three nights.
It's amazing stuff.
No, I mean, it's one of my favorite bands of all time. I mean, you know, one of my favorite shows ever was them on the Ghost in the Machine tour. The Go-Go's opened up. It's fantastic. I was at their, I was at the kickoff of the Synchronicity tour in June of 1983 at Old Comiskey. And the bill was The Police, The Fix, Flock of Seagulls, Ministry, back when Ministry sounded like Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, what the hell happened after that first album? and Joan Jett. And Joan Jett got booed off the stage. I love Joan Jett. But sure. that does stick out a little bit. Like that, you know, that lineup.
Well, yeah, because everybody's kind of new wave. Everybody, and she's a classic.
So they
punk.
they kind of booed her off the stage.
Fools.
Yeah, yeah. But it was an amazing show. Out there, you know, they kicked off the Synchronicity tour. It was unbelievable.
What is Ministry like on stage, especially in that era?
Well, that was like I said, they sounded like Depeche Mode.
So it's all synthesizers.
Yeah,
and I mean, even now, it's not, you know, they're doing industrial, so there's plenty of extra stuff.
Yeah. I told you the Al Jorgensen story, right?
Yeah. Al Jorgensen.
Hey, listen, what the hell happened after that first album?
It's still an amazing album. If I ever met Al, I'd see if I could get him to sign it. And I know
it's
he would kill you. But then I would have a story and be like, yeah, I got my ass kicked by Al Jorgensen.
It's the only album I like by them.
Yeah, the rest of it's like, eh.
I can't stand the industrial stuff. I'm with my old buddy Joe. With Sympathy is the only good Ministry album.
I'm guessing you're not a big Nine Inch Nails person, though.
No.
Although that first Nine Inch Nails is very unlike what would become of them later.
Well, I like only because of the movie Seven that I like that song.
Oh, Closer.
Yeah, that's the only reason, just because it's used at the beginning of Seven.
Yeah, and it was you couldn't turn on like Q101 without hearing it at least every hour.
How about this? Dolly Parton's Jolene, which is such a great song, came from the singer's two separate real-life experiences. She came up with the name during a show where she met a beautiful 8-year-old girl named Jolene, and the homewrecker angle came from a red-headed bank teller who developed a huge crush on her husband.
Bad for those bank tellers.
Yeah. You don't want to mess around. You don't want to mess around with Dolly Parton's husband. You don't want to do that.
She's going to choke you to death with that coat of many colors.
I love her.
Remarkable.
Yeah, she's the best. All right, let's take a quick break here. We've got more secrets behind and stories behind some of your favorite pop songs. That's all coming up right here. 312-981-7200. The news is up after this. All right, we're learning some secrets of stories behind some of our favorite music. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Yeah, so here's one. Desmond Child wrote "If You Were a Woman and I Was a Man" for Bonnie Tyler. Can you find that song? "If You Were a Woman and I Was a Man" for Bonnie Tyler. But the song did not reach the level of success that he was hoping for. So he rewrote it into "You Give Love a Bad Name" for Bon Jovi, just to prove that the song was meant to be a hit. So, well, I wonder what I don't know if I know the Bonnie Tyler song, but he rewrote it as "You Give Love a Bad Name."
Let's see here. Let's take a listen.
All right.
Are we that different? Tell me where we
I guess you can hear You Give Love a Bad Name in there somewhere. Yeah, Desmond Child. He wrote a lot of songs. But, yeah, so I guess you can hear a bit of You Give Love a Bad Name in that. Jeez, that was dated, though. Good Lord.
It's pretty 80s.
Oh, my God. You know, Bad was originally going to be a collaboration between Michael Jackson and Prince. Producer Quincy Jones says it was his idea to put these two rivals together and turn their antagonistic energy into pop gold. Apparently, though, it was a real hard pass for Prince.
Prince does not Prince does not do what Prince does not want to do.
That's right. God, it's amazing. Both of those guys are passed away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeez. Let's see. Here's Tony on WGN. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
This story is from one of the members of Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Uh-huh.
Wrote a book, and he tells a story about the time where their manager was all over their case because he needed some material. So he puts him in a sound studio and says, "You guys got to give me something. I'm going home. I'm going to bed. When I come back, I got to have something." Well, as time goes by through the night, he comes back. The band is spread out all over the sound stage, drunk, food boxes, pizza boxes laying all over the place. And they're out like a light. So he goes in with the engineer and he listens to the music. The music was great. He wakes him up. He says, "My God, that's one of the best songs you guys have ever done." He says, But God, who played the piano? And they look at each other. "I don't know who played the piano." And then finally one of the members of the band says, "Hey, I remember the guy that brought the pizzas." So every time you hear this song, and when you listen to that piano, it was the pizza delivery man.
What song?
Taking Care of Business.
Oh, it's Taking Care of Business. So the guy playing the piano was the pizza delivery guy.
Right, and he had aspirations of being in a symphony orchestra. And from what the story goes on, so he ended up being with the band for like 6 months. Then he went to his true passion, symphony, you know, orchestra.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah, it's in the book.
Yeah, that's a great story.
I don't know the title or anything like that.
All right, Tony, thanks, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, there you go. Pizza delivery man.
Now every time I hear it, I'm going to think of Domino's.
Yeah. That's a pretty cool story, though. They're all drunk. They don't even remember recording the song.
The pizza guy did it.
Pizza guy. Keith Richards produced the guitar riff for I Can't Get No Satisfaction while asleep. He woke up the next day without a clue until he heard a recording of about 2 minutes of guitar and then me snoring for the next 40 minutes. That's a true story.
So
he came up with that riff in his sleep.
He was just in his sleep. So was he like sleep playing? Like he just wasn't.
He recorded it, doesn't remember it.
My God.
You know, it's one of the greatest guitar riffs, one of the most legendary guitar riffs of all time. And he was asleep. Leave it to Keith Richards, you know?
Yeah, he could do it in his sleep.
Crazy. Sam Smith sang Stay With Me all by himself, no choir. He got the choir effect while layering his voice while standing in different spots about 20 times. And that's what we hear on the finished demo. The song was written in 32 minutes and recorded in a single take, but it wasn't until he added the harmonies that he felt like the whole song suddenly made sense.
I can't believe that there's no choir. Because I've heard, I mean, this song has been played on radio a million times.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just a choir. I thought it was him singing with a choir. But yeah, he just stood in different places 20 times.
20 times. Wow.
I got to say, though, I really hated his Bond song for Spectre.
I don't even remember.
Oh. It was originally Radiohead. They cut one. And then the producers, they decided against it. They were just like, "Oh, we're going to go a different direction." And then when Sam Smith won, he won the Oscar for it.
He did?
I don't know if it was the Oscar or no, sorry, it was the Grammy. He won a Grammy for it. And in the back room where they ask you all the questions, you know, yeah. the paparazzi and everything, they were just like, hey, have you heard Tom York's version of the Spectre theme song? And Sam Smith, like, bold-faced, looks at the reporters and says, oh, I don't know who that is. And I'm just like, he was just being petty.
He said he didn't know who Tom York was?
Yeah, he's British and definitely grew up, like, everybody, you just know who Tom York is.
Of course you do.
He's in Radiohead. And he also had to, what was it, for Stay With Me, he had to give a writing credit to Tom Petty.
Oh, yeah.
Because he totally cribbed the... And yeah. I'm not saying he's the first person to ever do that, but he totally cribbed it.
Yeah. Old Sam Smith. He's something, that Sam Smith.
Nah. It's for the birds.
How about this? Sia got the idea for Camila Cabello's crying in the club when she was on her way to the toilet while writing a demo with producer Benny Blanco. Okay. Anybody ever seen Sia's face?
I think people have, yeah. But I sure haven't.
How about this? Johnny Cash is The Man Comes Around. Comes from a dream about Queen Elizabeth. In the dream, Cash went into Buckingham Palace and saw Queen Elizabeth sitting on the floor. She told him, Johnny Cash, you're like a thorn tree in a whirlwind. After the dream had haunted him for years, he thought maybe it's biblical. So he looked through the Bible and found imagery of thorn trees and whirlwinds and started writing a song about them. And it's used at the beginning of Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead.
It's the best part of the movie, if you ask me. It's very effective. It freaked me out as a kid. I was like, oh, this song is all apocalyptic and stuff.
Yeah.
But that's kind of who he was at the end of his life.
I was obviously dead set against that remake. I was like, how dare you? And then I ended up liking it. Yeah, the zombies are fast. I'm not crazy about that. But I think it's definitely the best movie he's ever made. But without question, the best movie he's ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even think if there is I thought Watchmen was pretty good.
Yeah, I like that. 300's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but all the other ones. Ed Sheeran wrote A Fire Love for his grandfather, who never really knew the singer due to Alzheimer's disease. He began writing the song 2 weeks before his grandfather passed away. Oh.
He's really getting into the acting game. He's in Yesterday.
Well, he plays himself, though. So.
True. He's in an episode of Game of Thrones.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He was in an episode of Game of Thrones. That's right.
He's one of those. And then Aaron Rodgers was in one of the episodes of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I remember seeing the where they actually showed where he was. He was like in the he was one of the soldiers like standing at a wall. Like,
oh,
there he is, Aaron Rodgers. About this, Jeff Lynne of the Electric Light Orchestra wrote "Mr. Blue Sky" after holding himself up in a Swiss cabin to write music. After 2 weeks of failing to write anything, he looked over at the sunny sky over the Alps, which inspired him to write the song. Hmm.
I'm very excited to see them. They come at the end of the month.
Where are they playing? Rosemont?
I want to say...
The UC?
UC. First time I've ever seen ELO, though.
I saw them 1977 on the Out of the Blue tour with the big spaceship and the whole...
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like one of my favorite concerts of all time. And then like 5 years later, I'm at Jewel working. And stocking a shelf with a couple of guys, and we were talking about our favorite concerts, and I said, ELO, Chicago Stadium, 1977, one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life. And the guy goes, well, you know the whole thing was on tape, right? And I went, what? He said, yeah, they didn't play their instruments or anything, it was on tape. The whole thing was on tape. And I'm like, you just ruined one of my favorite childhood memories. So...
Harsh, man.
Yeah.
That's a bad look. But I guess when they're doing big rock shows like that, you know, they maybe favored the theatrics over the actual performance.
Well, I mean, it was ridiculous. The spaceship came down and it opened up. It was like this giant spaceship, lasers everywhere. and they were all like in white tails. The band was like in white tails and tuxes. But it was great. I mean, you know, even though, I mean, I found out later that there were, that not everything was on tape. There was a good portion of the music was, which disappointed me. But again, you know, it sounded great because it sounded exactly like the record.
Sure.
But I thought that show was still one of my favorite shows. I don't care.
It's more about the experience.
Yeah. And at that time when Out of the Blue came out, I mean, that was like when the record was out, you know, Mr. Blue Sky was. Now, you know, it's really funny because I love Mr. Blue Sky is one of my favorite songs, like of all time.
Oh, it's so much fun.
And, you know, obviously it wouldn't exist without the Beatles, but that's okay. Like a lot of stuff that ELO did wouldn't exist without the Beatles. But then, you know, he ended up like, you know, producing that Beatles record back when Anthology came out. And he worked with George Harrison. He was in the Traveling Wilburys. So clearly they like him. I just remember, you know, Mr. Blue Sky. I adore that song. But now, every time I hear Mr. Blue Sky, I think of Guardians of the Galaxy now. I can't.
Yeah,
I can't. With Little Groot. It's one of my favorite opening credit sequences of all time. Because, first of all, there's like this massive, crazy action stuff going on, but you don't see it. Like, you just see, you know, like the aftermath of somebody falling in the background. It's just Groot dancing to Mr. Blue Sky. With all kinds of crazy stuff going on in the background. That's one of my favorite opening credit sequences ever. Baby Groot.
Those are the only Marvel movies I'm going to continue to watch, really.
The Guardians of the Galaxy movies?
Yeah, maybe I'll see Spider-Man, but those Guardians of the Galaxy ones are just too much fun.
They are. They're a blast. They're really a lot of fun. And there was a lot of them in the Avengers in Endgame. There was a lot of Guardians in that.
They knew their audience. They were just like, we got to get these guys in.
Yeah. I was happy about that. I was like, okay, that's cool. But I prefer my, I've said this before. I prefer my Chris Pratt, chubby and dumb. Because I like Andy. I like him when he played Andy.
He was remarkable as Andy.
He was unbelievable on Parks and Rec. Unbelievably funny. But I always like my Chris Pratt, chubby and dumb. That's, and now he's all, you know, he's svelte.
He's a beefcake.
Yeah. I like him chubby and dumb. And it still makes me sad that he and Anna Faris didn't work out. Because
yeah.
I loved when they were a couple. That's like two people I adore. And he just remarried, right? He marry Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, he did.
He married Arnold's daughter, right?
Yeah. That's got to be a weird moment when your father-in-law is Arnie.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
The governator.
Yeah. That's a little weird. So, all right, let's take a quick break here. We've got more stories behind some of the songs that you probably know very well. And if you have any stories like Pizza Guys playing piano, 312-981-7200. We'll get back to it right after this. Yeah, so it's a day in the life. Whatever.
You know, I honestly didn't think about that until you mentioned it.
It's a day in the life.
Damn it.
I don't care. I love it. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5. Steve Grzanich coming up at 5. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we're talking about stories behind some popular songs. Let's see. 815 area code says, Prince was originally supposed to play Wesley Snipes' character at the beginning of the video Bad, but he did not feel comfortable with Michael Jackson's opening line, "Your butt is mine." What? Prince is uncomfortable with "Your butt is mine," considering the kind of lyrics that Prince has written?
Little red Corvette.
And he likes to have his butt hanging out all the time.
Yeah.
224 area code says, Jimi Hendrix's song Dolly Dagger, Mick stole Jimmy's girlfriend at a party. And then Jagger cut his finger, and Devon Wilson ran over to suck the blood from the jagged edge. Dolly Dagger. Okay. Bunch of weirdos.
Gotta be weird. Be a musician.
How about this? Leonard Cohen's record company, Columbia, originally refused to release his album with the song Hallelujah in the United States. They said it wasn't good enough. Cohen released various positions independently in 1984 to general indifference. So why is Hallelujah so popular? You can thank Shrek. Yes, a song full of religious and sexual imagery was made into a world was made world famous by 2001's Shrek, a cartoon movie for children.
That's how I found out about it.
That's how you found out about Hallelujah?
Yeah, and I loved that song. And I really had no idea. I mean, I was a kid. I didn't really know what he was talking about. I'm just like, ah, this is a good song. This is makes me you know, feel something. And then as I got older, I was like, oh, wow.
I don't remember. I mean, I haven't seen Shrek in years, but I don't remember. Where is it used in Shrek?
It is after, you know, before the finale where they all kind of split up. Like Shrek is like, ah, forget it. I'm going back to my swamp.
Yeah.
And Donkey's alone, and they have this whole thing where it's.
And then they play Hallelujah.
Yeah. But I don't even remember. Yeah, and it's not the Leonard Cohen version, it's the Jeff Buckley version.
Oh, right. Right.
I would say that probably made it more popular than Shrek alone, was that Jeff Buckley recorded.
Well, the Jeff Buckley recording of that song is probably the iconic one.
Yeah.
That most people remember.
If I had the opportunity, if Leonard were still with us, I'd ask him and be like, how do you feel about the Jeff Buckley version? I feel like he'd probably say the same thing that Trent Reznor said about Johnny Cash's version of Hurt. It's like, it's not really my song anymore.
Yeah. Yep. How about this? Kurt Cobain hated the recording of Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's such a perfect mixture of cleanliness and nice, candy-ass production. It may be extreme to some people who aren't used to it, but I think it's kind of lame myself.
That's how I feel. I don't like Butch Vig as a producer. Talented guy.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, what I love is Kurt Cobain totally cops to the fact that he ripped off Boston.
Yeah.
Like, Smells Like Teen Spirit is More Than a Feeling. And it totally says that. He's like, I just ripped off More Than a Feeling. That's all it is. It's the riff for More Than a Feeling. And it is. But I love the fact that Cobain was like, yeah, I totally ripped it off.
Well, it's always better to be honest. Mm-hmm. Just say, yeah, man, I was a big fan. 70s rock.
Oh, no, he was, yeah, man.
Loved the Beatles.
He never apologized for that, for liking that FM rock kind of stuff. You know, sure. Your Kansases and your Bostons and all that stuff.
And other bands named after states
and cities. But, yeah, no, I mean, he never was, you know, he was never embarrassed to admit that he liked corporate, he liked FM rock, you know?
It's just so weird that he ended up becoming, like, you know, the symbol of the counterculture.
That's the thing that, I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, why he had such a hard time with it, you know?
I know. Oh, my God.
It was, he became exactly what he didn't want to become. Yeah. It's a sad story, obviously. Mm-hmm. But
and now you can get his face on a t-shirt for $12.99 at Hot Topic.
Yeah. How about this? Macarena was a result of a sudden outburst. One night, Antonio Romero Mange of the duo Los Del Rio watched a great performance from one of their dancers and called her in Spanish, Diana, give joy and good things to your body. Los Del Rio used that as a refrain and then wrote a song around it called the Macarena.
I think that should really be banned from most public performance, specifically weddings.
Well, I got married in 1996, okay? At the height of the popularity of that song. And at the reception, my ex-wife and I told the DJ that if he played the Macarena, we would kill him. You will not play the Macarena. And he didn't. But you couldn't get away from it in 1996. It was everywhere. He did play the chicken dance, of course.
Well, you know, that's
which is absolutely necessary.
The Stone Cold classic.
Yeah.
That's up there with like Beethoven.
Well, we had to, it was funny because like I was with the Factory Theater at that time, and I had directed a show called White Trash Wedding and a Funeral, which features a key plot point involves the chicken dance. And so we clearly had to play it because the entire cast was at our wedding, and so we clearly had to play the chicken dance. So
I don't know if that can top. Can it top? No means no being played and clearing the dance floor.
That was a different wedding.
At a different wedding.
Yeah, that was a different wedding.
But still,
yeah,
legendary.
Yeah, yeah. That was a different wedding. That was my second wedding. How about this? Grand Funks were an American band. Has a verse mentioning Sweet Sweet Connie, which refers to Connie Hamsey of Little Rock, Arkansas. Hamsey is one of the most famous rock and roll groupies and claims to have had sex with an impressive list of men, including Keith Moon, Don Henley, Peter Frampton, Neil Diamond, Eddie and Alex Van Halen, and Bill Clinton before he was president. Wow. Connie Hamsey.
That's a shame about Don Henley, though.
Don Henley.
Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
That's a good get.
Yeah, I guess. How about this? The iconic disco hit Disco Inferno by the Tramps was actually inspired by the 1974 disaster movie The Towering Inferno with Steve McQueen? What? I didn't know that.
That'll change the way you watch that movie.
Now I like the song even more. Inspired by The Towering Inferno with Steve McQueen. Don't forget Paul Newman, man. Paul Newman's in that movie too. Don't be dissing out on the Paul Newman. I mean, I understand Steve McQueen is awesome, but
of course.
Paul Newman's in that movie, man. That was back when like every other week there was a disaster movie. In the '70s, it was nothing. Just to say, once Airport made money, that was it.
I can't think of a really great disaster movie that's come out since Twister.
Twister's awesome.
Twister's amazing. Yeah. But then, like, what? Maybe The Day After Tomorrow?
No.
Yeah. Doesn't. No. What's the last great disaster movie? That's what I want to know.
I like Deep Impact.
Yeah, that's where it stops, though, because it's space.
All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up right after this. Towering Inferno. Wow. All right. Learning some stuff about some songs, some stories behind some of the songs. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to jump in here. How about this? Andre 3000. I knew this one. Andre 3000 wrote Outkast, wrote Miss Jackson as an apology of sorts to the mother of his former partner, Erykah Badu. Badu wasn't entirely thrilled with the track at first, but when asked how her mother felt about it, she said she bought her a Miss Jackson license plate. She has the mug. She has the ink pen. She had the headband. She has everything. She loves it.
All right. Merchandising.
Yep. But I did know the backstory on that one, though. Let's see. We got some more texts coming in here. 312-981-7200. 773 area code says, an interesting musical fact that Bill Cosby played the bongo intro on the OJ's I Love Music. Bill Cosby? Wow. 312 area code says, Cheap Trick's Ballad of TV Violence is about the Richard Speck murders in Chicago, showing a dark side that was long forgotten. All right. How about this? Stevie Nicks' Stand Back ripped off a Prince song, and he was totally cool with it. Nicks wrote the song over the melody for Little Red Corvette. She called Prince to offer him writing credit and asked if he wanted to hear it. To her amazement, he never came over, gave it a listen. He came over, gave it a listen, and proceeded to play the new synthesizer parts for the song. So he ripped off. Can you find Stand Back here?
Yeah, I'm pulling it up here because I've never heard this song, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, you have. I'm sure you have. But it's melody. She wrote it over the melody of Little Red Corvette, and Prince ended up playing the synthesizer on it. You can hear it.
It's definitely there.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, though. Prince was like, yeah, it's cool, man. I'll play on it, too.
He's just one of the, I mean, you know, they just released an album called Prince Originals. And it's him playing all the songs that he wrote and then gave to other artists. You know, like, Nothing Compares to You. But I watched a video of him playing Manic Monday.
Yeah.
And that's so weird to hear him doing it, because I'm, you know, obviously it's so associated with the Bengals.
He was insanely prolific, like Prince. Just, you know, that's all he did was record music. That's all he did was play and record music. So, but yeah, you know, but for, you know, the original Nothing Compares to You was written for a band called The Family. That was the first version of Nothing Compares to You was with this was in this band called The Family, and it was with Wendy Melvoin of Lisa and Wendy fame. Her twin sister Susanna was in that band, and Wendy is obviously a twin with Susanna. And that's the very first version of Nothing Compares to You was on the album by The Family. And then, of course, he's got his own version of it. But, I mean, you know, obviously everybody knows the Sinead O'Connor version of it. But, yeah. About this, Shaggy's hit song, It Wasn't Me, was inspired by a skit Eddie Murphy did in Raw about men being unfaithful and denying it. So Shaggy was inspired by Eddie Murphy.
That was another one you couldn't escape.
What?
It Wasn't Me?
Oh, yeah.
It was on 24/7.
How about this? During the shooting of the music video for Taylor Swift's Shake It Off, heavy metal music was played around the perimeter of the studio so no one could hear the unreleased song. Really? I couldn't tell you what Shake It Off is if you...
Oh. Even if you heard it?
Maybe. I don't know. Not a big Tay-Tay fan.
No?
No. I will say this, though. I really, the first time she was on SNL, when she hosted, when she was still, like, kind of country, I really thought she did a great job. And I remember being really, really charmed by her. Because she sang, I'm hosting it. She sang a song about her hosting SNL. And at that time, she was dating the Wolfman from the Twilight movies.
Oh.
Name is Taylor, too.
Oh, yeah.
Lautner?
Yeah, Taylor Lautner.
Yeah, she was dating him at the time.
The Wolfman.
Whatever. Whatever.
I know, that's what he is.
He was a wolf, right? He was a wolf.
He was a kid that turned into a wolf.
I'll tell you something. Those movies are terrible. And I can't believe that last one, the last Twilight movie, where like there is like a 15-minute insane battle with beheadings and all kinds of stuff, and then it doesn't happen. I was like, "Are you kidding me? What?
Not fair."
And what the hell was Michael Sheen doing? What is he doing?
He's hamming it up. He's chewing scenery. Everybody deserves. But
I remember sitting in the theater. I saw it at the, you know, for free at the Davis. We went one night, had a few drinks at Ricochet's, and then went and saw it. We went to the midnight show. And you know, it was like 9 hours long, too. The movie was like 9 hours long. And it was the second part, because remember, it had two different movies, right?
Yeah, it was part of that fad when people were just like, oh, we could just split it up into two movies, make twice the money.
That's what they did with the last Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter did it with The Hobbit, split that into three movies.
Well, that was unnecessary.
Yeah.
That was completely unnecessary. There were some things in The Hobbit that I liked.
Sure.
But... I mean, that's a children's book that, you know, it's not, I can understand making three movies out of The Lord of the Rings. That I can understand.
Yeah.
But not out of The Hobbit.
No. No, 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 no.
I was very disappointed.
But you had to, were you reviewing it for the show?
Reviewing
Twilight?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I just remember, like, because I don't know what the hell's going on. I've seen the movies. I don't know what's going on. And it's the incredible thing is how those two actors have really turned into something great. How they, you know what I mean? You couldn't have told me 10 years ago or whenever those stupid movies came out that Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson would be two of the most interesting and best actors doing like really amazing and interesting work.
Mm-hmm.
I would have said, shut up.
You see, she's going to be in Charlie's Angels.
Yeah.
I like that.
I love her.
Works for me.
I think she's great. And I think he's great too. And you know, like I said, man, if you would have told me that, like after seeing these Twilight movies with the sparkling vampires and stuff, I'd have been like, no. But she's great, man, and he's great too. Did you see Good Time?
Yeah, I got to see that. They showed it at the Music Box in 35, and they did in the little theater, second theater. I've never been so tense.
It's crazy.
It was the only movie that came out recently that got me that tense.
It's a crazy movie.
Yeah.
It was
like
crazy.
Green Room level intensity. I was just like, nah, I can't. I could barely do it. I was shaking afterward.
Yeah. God, Green Room. Phenomenal movie. I told you the story about seeing that movie, right?
Yeah, the Prince
thing. Yeah.
Oh.
It's like the day after Prince died, and they made the Prince reference, and everybody started applauding.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful. Let's see. The title of the song, Cake by the Ocean by DNCE. Was the result of a Swedish production duo Mattman and Robin misunderstanding the phrase sex on the beach. Cake by the Ocean?
It's an insufferable song.
I don't even think I know it. What is it?
It's this group, the only real claim to fame they have is that one of the Jonas Brothers is in it. I don't know which one.
A Jonas Brothers is in the band?
Yeah, he's in the band.
Oh, I see. I'm looking at a picture.
Yeah, there he is.
Okay, I see him.
With those caterpillars for eyebrows.
Yeah.
And, this was a hit. It's a very standard pop song.
Cake by the Ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know it.
Not super lame. Mattman and Robin.
The White Stripes, Seven Nation Army. The lyrics of the song proclaim, I'm going to Wichita. Jack White says that he has never actually been to Wichita, and at this point he will never visit out of respect for using the city as a metaphor. What? Oh, the White Stripes.
He was in the news this weekend because he was quoted in the Irish Post. He was talking, he's got a new album out with his band, The Raconteurs. And he was quoted as saying that it took so long because he started doing heroin.
What?
But he was kidding. He was just being facetious. But every music publication picked it up saying, oh, Jack White started taking heroin.
Come on.
And he did this whole long diatribe about how the music press is this and that. And I'm like, well, maybe in an interview, don't say that you started doing heroin.
Yeah.
You know, because people, they don't have any context for how you're saying it. You're there. It's just words on a page.
Right. Oh. That's not smart.
It freaked me out for a second. I like Jack White, and I was like, oh, wow, he just decided to start doing smack out of nowhere, just because.
Brad Arnold from Three Doors Down wrote Kryptonite when he was 15 during his math class. Oh, there's a shocker.
Sounds like it was written by a 15-year-old
wrote that song? Three Doors Down. All right. The iconic drum beats at the end of Living on the Edge by Aerosmith were played on a bass drum that Steven Tyler stole from his high school after senior prom. Steven Tyler.
How did he give? How did he sire Liv Tyler?
I'm not real sure. Not real sure. A bass drum that he stole from high school. All right. We got to take a break here. We got more stories behind the songs here. 312-981-7200 if you know any tidbits you want to jump in. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell the joke because it's a jokey time. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We have been talking about some of the stories behind some of your favorite songs and getting some stories about that. Chris from Lakeview sent in a text, and you can too. You can call us or text us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Rod Stewart's hit Do You Think I'm Sexy was musically from a song by South American singer Jorge Ben. As part of a copyright settlement, Stewart signed off song rights to UNICEF in a nationally televised concert for UNICEF. Oh, okay. Let's see, here's Don on WGN. Hi, Don.
How you doing? How are you?
All right.
First of all, I tell you guys are great. I listen to you guys all the time.
Thank you.
I just thought of another one, but the first one I was talking about was Phil Collins in the Air Tonight. I heard a story behind that that he thought he'd seen somebody drown somebody, and I guess he, you know, they thought the person was in the audience, and he was like looking at him while he was singing a song. But on tonight's show, I forgot which one it was. It was about his divorce.
Yeah, yeah. It's not. It's the whole rumor about seeing someone drown is not true at all.
No, I didn't think. I thought it. Then I'm thinking, ah, that can't be. You know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Not true.
No. And then Def Leppard is one of my favorite bands, and I guess the Photograph was about Marilyn Monroe. If you know,
yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
It is.
But okay, that's yeah. What I was told.
Yeah, it is. It's about Marilyn Monroe. Absolutely.
Okay.
All right, Don, thanks.
Well, you have a good night.
Okay.
Thanks.
By the way, I love that song.
Def Leppard.
Photograph. One of my favorite songs of all time. It's a perfect song. It's a perfect song. According to Axl Rose, the seed for Welcome to the Jungle was planted when he and a friend hitchhiked to New York City while wandering around a Caribbean neighborhood. An old man came over, looked at them, and said, "Do you know where you are? You're in the jungle, baby. You're going to die."
I would be in a full-on panic. I'd be like, what the hell?
Oh, man. And then this is the last one. Don't Stop Believin' was an improvisational collaboration between keyboardist Jonathan Cain and singer Steve Perry. Cain only knew he wanted to base a song around that phrase, since it was something that his dad used to say to him. He used John Mellencamp's Jack and Diane as inspiration, and the rest was improvised. Jack and Diane?
It's beyond me, man.
Wow.
Still my first concert was Journey.
Journey was your first concert?
Yeah, Journey, Cheap Trick, and Heart.
That's a good lineup.
Yeah, I was at Tinley Park. I was 15.
Wow.
Went to the Denny's afterward.
That sounds like a night.
Yeah. the thing that kept us going was a jug of Hawaiian Punch that we kept calling Hooch. Just say, hey, pass the Hooch, and it was just Hawaiian Punch.
All it was Hawaiian Punch.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were definitely wired after an entire jug of Hawaiian Punch.
I can imagine.
400 milligrams of sugar or whatever.
What was the Journey headline?
Yeah, they were headlining. So Cheap Trick opened, they were first.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for mainly Journey and Cheap Trick. I was not a huge fan of Heart. I liked Heart. But yeah, it was Cheap Trick, then followed by Heart. And actually, Heart really brought down the house. They did an amazing job.
Yeah, they're great.
Incredible. They did Going to California, you know. I'm pretty sure they did Stairway, among their other hits. I'm a big fan of Barracuda. That one always gets the blood going. And then Journey, it was the tour without Steve Perry.
Oh.
It was the guy that they found in where, like, the Philippines or whatever.
Yeah. Well, that was the and his name was Steve. Like, they've hired two different singers, all named Steve.
All named Steve.
I guess that's prerequisite in order to sing for Journey. Your first name has to be Steve.
Can you belt it? Is your name Steve?
Yeah.
But he was incredible. I was shocked at how much he sounded exactly like Steve Perry.
He did sound exactly like Steve Perry, which is not an easy thing to do, no. Considering Steve Perry is like one of the most unique voices in rock,
mm-hmm.
and has a fantastic voice.
Yeah, but it was weird being there at 15, because everybody around us was like, you know, in their mid to late 40s,
well, yeah.
50s, and they were like, hey, man, I didn't know kids listen to music. This is the good stuff, man. You guys know what you're listening to.
What are they, weirdos? What?
Yeah, no, the total weirdos. They're like, hey, man, you want to smoke this joint? I was like, I'm 15. And they were like, oh, man, I remember when I was 50.
Yeah. Jeez, man.
Passed out on Coors Light by the end of the fourth song.
I went to go see Rush on the Moving Pictures tour. In fact, it was like 1981 or 82. It was at the Rosemont Horizon, or the Allstate Arena was the Rosemont Horizon. And, we had really good seats. We were like eighth row center. So as people are prone to do, we were all standing on our chairs. You know, we were on the main floor, so it was like the metal folding chairs that they put out. So we were all standing on the chairs, and all of a sudden I feel something hit the back of my leg, like a warm liquid hit the back of my leg. And I look, and a guy threw up on my leg. The guy behind me vomited on my leg.
Oh, man.
And I was like, and then he looks up at me, because I'm standing on the chair. He looks up at me. He's like, sorry, dude, I lost it. And I'm like, yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. So he's like, I'll buy you a beer. And I was like, same thing. You know, I was like 15. I'm like, no, that's all right, man. So I had to go to the – I missed like four songs because I had to go to the bathroom and stick my leg in a sink.
And just wash it right
off. And wash and wash and wash and wash, you know. And then it was in my shoe. I had to, you know. And so it was like February. And I remember when we left, like, my pants were frozen to my leg. My leg. This guy threw up all over my leg. So, you know, my friend, I've talked about my friend Scott Oaken in the past. He's a big guy. Scott's a big dude. So we went to a concert, and we were on the main floor at Rosemont Horizon, and he was rocking so hard. He was jamming so hard on the chairs that he collapsed one of the chairs. He went through it. So we all had to, like, move down a little bit so he could, like, balance himself back up on the stairs. He was rocking so hard, he busted another chair. Went through that one. So now we're all kind of, like, gathered together close. Busts another chair. He went through three chairs.
What? Scott?
He went through three chairs. He busted through three chairs. You want to know what the show was?
What?
The Hooters and Bryan Adams. He busted one chair during the Hooters and two chairs during Bryan Adams. That's how hard he was rocking. I love the fact that that was the show.
Well,
the Hooters and Bryan Adams.
He's got to be the first and only and last person to do that. To rock so hard at a Bryan Adams concert.
Hooters and Bryan Adams. Don't forget about the Hooters.
We can't, pardon. He apologies to the Hooters.
He busted through during the Hooters set, and then two songs. He busted through two songs to Bryan Adams, and we were all kind of balanced. We all had to
was
move
it
down.
Was it Run to You? Like what?
He busted one chair during Kids Are Gonna Rock, and he busted another chair during. Oh man, I'm trying to remember. Cuts Like a Knife, and then he busted the other chair during the Hooters. It was And We Danced. He busted the chair during And We Danced.
Oh my God!
It's a legendary. You know, it's just ridiculous. And he demolished these chairs. Like he went through because he's a big dude.
Sure.
And he was rocking so hard that just like the whole chairs did just completely were annihilated.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that. You know, I gotta say, as a big guy myself, you know, I have to be when I'm at concerts. I usually try to actually stand towards the back because I know I'm like. people are trying to look around me. I'm 6 foot four.
Yeah.
I take up a decent amount of space. I kind of go to the back. I don't participate in mosh pits.
Right.
One, because I hate them. I find them to be really annoying and obnoxious. But two,
do they still do that?
Is
that still a thing?
Yes and no.
It seems like a 90s thing to me.
Depending on who you're going to see, you might get some slam dancing going on. But nothing, nothing like it was back in the day, I guess.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that I knocked Sebastian Bach on his ass?
Good.
Because he was at it. We were at a Soundgarden show, and we were down on the main floor, and he was coming out. And he just, I don't know what he was doing there, but there's Sebastian Bach from Skid Row. He runs out into the crowd and starts pushing people, like knocking them over and stuff, like starting a mosh pit. So I knocked him on his ass.
And you hit him so hard that
he went down.
He went down, and he had to be on VH1.
That's right. All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up after this.
A Monday warrior, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean pride.
Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you would like to jump in. And, yeah. So we're going to talk here now about the most American movies set in each state. So here's the whole setup here. To be clear, the movies listed here are not intended to convey what life is like for each individual state. To confine what it means to be a Californian or an Ohioan or a Georgian in just one film invariably would lead to stereotyping. Also, America is now nearly 250 years old. Life in the United States has changed considerably over the years. Instead, this list will consider at least 50 of the various attributes that comprise the American character. Accordingly, not every American movie on this list casts our country in positive light. But since things like racism, sexism, classism, excess, and xenophobia are part of American life, excluding those negative aspects about the country would not make any sense. That said, the list is not intended to be a bummer. But let's begin with the state of Alabama. So the movie that they chose for Alabama is, well, not surprisingly, they chose Selma. Any list of films detailing the nature of the American experience has to include an American movie dealing with the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And while a number of films have chronicled that particular moment in history, few have done so with clarity as Selma. The film presents a ground level view of the 1965 Selma to Montgomery protest marches in Alabama. Selma is a film that serves as an essential document that can be achieved when ordinary Americans stand by their convictions, even if those convictions require them to sacrifice their comfort, their safety, and even the lives in service of a greater cause. I wonder what they chose for Illinois. We'll get to it. Alaska. They chose Insomnia. which is a movie that I really love.
Have you seen the original Swedish one?
Sure, yeah.
I love both of them.
So
really. I think they're both great.
Oh, I got a sneeze here, I think.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's funny because there was a period of time when the only Christopher Nolan movies that I liked were one-word titles that began with the letters I and N. Because there's Insomnia, there's Inception, there's Inner Space.
Interstellar.
Inner Space. That's a Joe Dante movie. You've seen Inner Space, right?
Yeah, I've seen Inner Space.
Yes.
That's interesting. You're not a Memento person?
Oh, I am, yeah. I like Memento. I like Dunkirk, too. So I guess
that's not Dark Knight.
That's not Batman related.
Yeah. I don't think that's a bad way to be. Because it's like, he's more than just that.
I didn't like The Prestige, either.
Mm-hmm. I would switch out Interstellar with The Prestige. I enjoyed The Prestige, Interstellar.
I love Interstellar. I love that movie.
Well, it's just nice that at least once a month I get to hear Rod clown on you for liking Interstellar.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? I still love that movie, man.
I know. You're not alone. Obviously, you're not alone. Huge success.
I couldn't believe how emotional I was during that movie. Like, I was a wreck when I first saw Interstellar. I was a wreck. Man, oh man, I had no idea it was going to go that way. I mean, I saw it at the Davis, and then like afterwards, I was an emotional wreck. I just went to Ricochet's and started drinking. It's like, my God. All right. Well, anyway, insomnia. With a population of more than 325 million people, the United States is the third most populous country on Earth, with an area of 9.63 million square kilometers. It's the third largest nation on Earth. While most Americans embrace their essential nature as social animals, some seek to get away from other people and lose themselves. Insomnia was one of those movies. I'm not a big Robin Williams guy, like, at all, but I think he's great in this. And so is Pacino. I always thought that the movies that I liked Robin Williams in, when he plays psychos, because 1 Hour Photo, I thought he was really good. in 1 Hour Photo. I think he's great in Insomnia. But my favorite Robin Williams performance, like, by far, and it's not even close, is World's Greatest Dad. I love that movie so much. And it was funny because I've had Bobcat on the show a couple times, and it gets brought up every time I'll never forget the first time I saw that movie, man. I told you this already. It was like a Friday afternoon, the day it opened, and it was at the Landmark Century matinee. So I'm there first showing of the day. It's like 11 in the morning or noon or something like that. And the crowd, well, there wasn't a big crowd, but they were mostly, you know, like, senior citizens, you know, a matinee. And I think that they were expecting, you know, hey, World's Greatest Dad, you know,
Patch Adams,
Robin Williams, World's Greatest Dad. And the poster, you know, the poster didn't deny that. Like, the poster is like, World's Greatest Dad. And like 10 minutes into the movie, for those of you who've seen World's Greatest Dad, let's just say that there were some walkouts. And that, you know, like, I'm sure that that's not at all what those people expected this movie to be. And they just, no, that's it. We're out of here.
Even better.
I love that movie.
I appreciate how bold it is.
Yeah.
I like it a lot. I think it's incredibly darkly funny. I just find it horrendously hard to watch.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult movie to watch. Without question.
Yeah. 100% Bobcat, though.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So it's so him. It's yeah. So.
I had Joel Murray on in December because we showed Scrooged. And we did a whole tie-in with the Caddyshack restaurant, which we have been doing lately. And I had him on, and we talked about God Bless America. Bobcat's movies, man. You know, it's crazy because back when he was just the goofball from the Police Academy movies, I would have never thought that he was gonna emerge as this really, really talented dark satire filmmaker. Never would have thought that in a million years, but he's made some great movies, and they're all twisted. But he couldn't be a nicer guy. That's the thing.
God Bless America is hilarious.
Oh man,
I think that was when I was a freshman in college. It was one of those nights where you're still trying to get to know everybody.
Yeah.
And, come on over to my dorm. We're going to watch a movie. Uh-huh. No one could decide on what to watch. I was like, oh, there's this movie called God Bless America. Put that on.
Yeah. It's something, man. It's something. The little girl is great, too.
She's very, very good.
All right, Arizona is represented by my darling Clementine. You could have done a lot of, you could have gone a lot of different ways with Arizona. But I guess, you know, I mean, I'm guessing that would probably be the, because it's a Wyatt Earp movie and Henry Fonda's in it. But yeah, that one does represent Arizona. How about Arkansas? Walk the Line. Although Christianity informs a great deal of American culture, customs, and traditions, it's generally not a topic that contemporary American films deal with very well. While there is a thriving Christian film community in our country, its output typically consists of films that celebrate the tenets and practices of Christianity. Consequently, they only serve to preach to the choir and holds little interest of mainstream filmgoers. Hollywood films tend to treat the faith in one of two ways, dismissively or incidentally. However, one of the few modern films that do right by Christianity is James Mangold's Walk the Line. The film follows legendary singer-songwriter and Arkansas native Johnny Cash, played by Joaquin Phoenix, through the first 30 or so years of his life. As the film details, it was during that time that Cash became a country singer and superstar and a self-destructor abuser of drugs and alcohol. As the film shows, Cash was not driven to addiction simply by his success. Tragedies in his early life, as well as deep-seated familial dysfunction, were also contributing factors. But it was the excess and money that came with the fame that Cash's chemical dependency grew out of control. As Walk the Line shows, it was only through the rediscovery of his Christian faith that Cash was able to pull out of that spiral. By subtly showcasing how Christianity shaped Cash's life, Walk the Line tells a story that is essential to understanding what it means to be an American.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, that's a very good way to put it.
It is a great way to put it, yeah.
And I still think it's my favorite music biopic.
Is Walk the Line?
Yeah. And I'm not saying that. There aren't other great ones. For some reason, I have a predilection for, like, country. Like, I find country biopics really interesting. Like, yeah. I think Coal Miner's Daughter is amazing.
Great movie.
So good.
Great movie. Sissy Spacek is unbelievable. You know who else is great in that movie? Beverly D'Angelo.
Yep.
No, that's a terrific movie. I also like Walk Hard. That is a hilarious movie. Man, you don't want a part of this.
And you never paid for drugs.
Yeah.
Not once.
Hilarious. Hilarious movie. But yeah, as far as I gotta say, I love Rocket Man. I know it's in the theaters. I love that movie. I love that movie.
I like it more as a musical than I do as a story about Elton John.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's more of a musical fantasy than anything else, but I really like it.
It was very entertaining. I'll say that much.
That was just the only thing I've said before. The only thing that I was disappointed about was that, they don't someone perform save my life. Someone Save My Life Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, why isn't it's like one of his greatest songs, one of the most important songs personally to him,
mm-hmm.
not in the movie. So, but I'm not complaining because there's like 9,000 songs in the movie. So.
Yeah, all of them great. All of them performed with spectacular
Beautiful.
Imagery.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break here. We got more movies that represent the states that get represented by movies. California, I'm looking at the title for California. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. And we'll get to that in a second. And we'll find out what how Illinois is represented, what movie. All that and more. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black. Why you never see bright colors on my back. And why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, and we're here until 5 a.m. If you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. All right, we're going state by state here and what movies represent each state. So we're at California, and the website here is fan-sided, by the way, and they chose Chinatown, which that is as quintessential a California movie as you can possibly get. I know there are a lot of films that kind of represent California. I think Paul Thomas Anderson makes great movies about California, including Magnolia, including Boogie Nights. But Chinatown, I mean, that's, you know, I think that's as good a, that's as good an example as you're going to get.
It's iconic.
Yeah.
The whole water subplot.
Yeah. Man, there's a lot of them though that you could choose. For those who have never been to the Golden State, it should be known that California is an even stranger place than its reputation suggests. Yes, it is. Impossibly vast and as ideologically diverse as it gets, the state feels very different. Therefore, the state can be seen as a microcosm of the United States. Since Hollywood is in California, countless filmmakers have made countless films examining the state's many peculiarities and contradictions. However, none quite captured as well as Roman Polanski's Chinatown. Although the classic 1974 neo-noir film is best known for its captivating performances, twisty plot, devastating ending, it is also the quintessential Californian story. Chinatown follows Detective Jake Gittes, played by Jack Nicholson, as he investigates what's ends up being the biggest case of his life. Initially hired to produce evidence of a husband's infidelity, Jake winds up in the middle of a sprawling conspiracy that involves water rights and land development, specifically how some wealthy Californians are intent on wiping out their entire communities in order to artificially turn Southern California into a thriving, lucrative community. As such, Chinatown is representative of three quintessentially American realities. The first is that America's remarkable infrastructure development is not achieved cleanly. Two, that intense class conflict has existed in America long before the term became popular in the 21st century. And third, that the injustices that are fueled by American progress almost a century ago are still present today. That, of course, you know, has been known. I mean, that Chinatown is an example of a perfect screenplay. Like, it doesn't get better than that. Like, that's Robert Towne's screenplay for Chinatown is perfect in every possible way. It's like, you know, you want to learn about screenwriting? You want screenwriting 101? Chinatown. So, Colorado, they picked Dogville.
The Lars von Trier movie?
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't really think of any other movies about Colorado, though. Is Dogville even about Colorado?
It takes place there.
It does. It does. Oh, my God.
I'm trying to think. Colorado, aren't there any great movies that take place in Denver? How about Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead?
Where's South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut?
There you go, right there. South Park, that should be Colorado. Absolutely. South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut. I love that movie. Oh, man. Yeah, I would pick that over Dogville, for sure. Let's see. Connecticut. Oh, yeah, the ice storm.
Yeah. You have to.
Oh, man, I love that movie. Not the happiest movie in the world. Whether it's Richard Yates' Revolutionary Road, Sloan Wilson's The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, or Rick Moody's The Ice Storm, Connecticut has often been used as a setting in books and films that want to explore the stifling nature of American suburbia. All of the above-listed works of literature have been made into feature films that intended to say something profound about America. But only the film version of The Ice Storm, directed by Ang Lee, nails how stultifying the suburbs can be. Set in 1978, it revolves around two Connecticut families, the Carvers and the Hoods. The adult members of both families have fallen into a familiar trap. Likely owning to its monumental darkness, The Ice Storm was not a financial success upon its release. However, it has since come to be regarded as a classic American movie because of how honestly it portrays post-World War II American ennui. It's such a great movie. I mean, and everybody is so good in it. Like, the acting is just amazing. That was the first time I ever remember seeing Tobey Maguire. the first time I ever remember seeing him.
Good old Tugboat. Tugboat McGuire.
And then the kid who was in the Jodie Foster movie about the smart kid. Little Man Tate. He's the younger brother. So, and of course, Christina Ricci is amazing. Sigourney Weaver. Kevin Klein. One of my favorite Kevin Klein performances of all time. He's heartbreaking in that movie. And it really is a devastating film. I mean, it really is. I'm not shocked that it didn't make a lot of money upon its release. But all right, what about Delaware? Let's see. Fight Club.
I didn't know that that took place identifiably anywhere.
It doesn't take place identifiably anywhere, does it?
So therefore, Delaware.
Because of its small area and low population, Delaware is not one of America's most notable states. Its history has been mythologized by well-regarded books, movies, and TV shows. And the state isn't represented any major professional teams. However, Delaware is notable in that due to the extremely favorable corporate tax laws, America's publicly traded companies are incorporated there. The fact that the state is essentially a nexus point for corporate America likely played into David Fincher's decision to set his film adaptation of Fight Club there. Really?
That's a bit of trivia.
I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to give me another excuse to watch Fight Club. I was not aware that it took place. I didn't think it took place anywhere like specific. Most Americans who have enjoyed Fight Club probably won't agree with Tyler's ultimate solution for corporate-induced melancholia, but if they were honest, they would likely admit some affinity for his philosophy of total freedom and all responsibility. Still one of my favorite final shots in movie history.
You met me in a really weird time in my life.
I just love that final shot, and I know that it's it's a lot different than the book, and I know that a lot of people were disappointed with that. And having, you know, I read the book. I got to say that I've said this a million times. I always envy people who got to see Fight Club and experience the twist because I'd read the book.
Dude, I nearly crapped my pants with that.
Yeah,
I was maybe 14. I was like, what?
Yeah. I knew the twist, so I read the book beforehand, and I'll never know what it was like to find out when you find out that the narrator is Tyler. And it's just so weird. So, great book, though. I was glad I read the book, because the book is great. And then the movie, I did not know the movie was set in Delaware. I had no idea. That is so crazy. So, okay, we got some texts coming in. If you want to jump in here, we're talking about movies that take place in different states, and we're going to get to Florida next. So, if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. If you would like to jump in, we're going state by state here and movie by movie. More coming up right after the news, which is coming up next. Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we are talking about article where each state has been represented by a movie. Like, what movie would represent Illinois? We'll get to that in a little bit. And we've been going through some of these, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Chris from Lakeview says, Misery is a gray, cold look at Maine's endless winter. Yeah, that's true. All of the Stephen King movies take place in Maine. 219 area code says, the terrible movie with Kevin Costner about bicycling known as American Flyers. That's in Colorado. I actually like that movie.
You seem to have a thing for bicycle movies.
Yeah. Well, Breaking Away. I mean, that's the best. What's that stupid movie with
Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Yeah.
Premium Rush.
Love that movie.
What?
I love that movie.
Come on.
Michael Shannon rules the planet in that movie.
I mean, yes, because we're talking about Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
You could put Michael Shannon in it. He was just in like a family-friendly Christmas movie. He's delightful.
Yeah.
He's great, but that doesn't make Premium Rush good.
I love that movie. I love that movie.
My God.
Yeah, Eric and I backed that one, too. Eric Childress. We totally backed that movie. We saw it at the screening together, and was like, when it was over, was like, man, that was fantastic.
In the edgy world of bike messengers.
Bike messengers. Hey, you ever see the movie Quicksilver?
No. Is this also about bike messengers?
Oh, yeah.
Am I missing out on an entire subgenre?
Kevin Bacon, my man.
All right. I'll watch anything with Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon, Lawrence Fishburne, when he was known as Larry Fishburne.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
Quicksilver,
man. I can't remember who the female lead is in Quicksilver. Oh, man. I don't remember. I want to say, was it Jamie Gertz? No. I can't remember who the female lead.
But I'll figure this out.
Quicksilver. Like 86, maybe? 85, 86, it came out? Um, 708 area code says, silly but entertaining Eastwood movie, The Gauntlet, which is set in Phoenix. The Gauntlet's a great movie.
It's Kevin Bacon, Jamie Gertz.
It was Jamie Gertz.
Yeah. That's Terry.
Okay. Let's see. 847 area code. Did The Shining take place in Colorado? Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd put that for Colorado.
773 area code says, hey, Nick, The Unsinkable Molly Brown was a movie based on a Denver resident. All right.
Yeah, a woman who survived the Titanic. Yeah.
Here's Mary on WGN. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Yeah, I have a movie I liked, and it was with Heather Lockwood. It's called Angel Falls. Mm. I think that was either Colorado or Wyoming.
Oh, I don't know that one.
No, it's really, really good. It's a mystery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's called Angel Falls.
Angel Falls. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thanks, Mary.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care. All right, so Florida. You know what they picked for Florida?
Mm. Was it Hoot?
Hoot?
Yeah, with Brie Larson. That takes place in Florida.
Hoot? What is that?
You never heard of Hoot?
And Brie Larson is in it?
Yeah. It's when she was like, I don't know, she's probably like 15 or something.
Oh, okay.
It was like way, way back.
Because I love Brie Larson.
Yeah.
I don't know Hoot. Is it about owls?
Yeah. It's based on a kid's novel.
Is it animated?
No. It's kid, you know, like a right. It's a live action movie.
Are there owls in it?
Yes.
Do they talk?
They do not talk. The plot involves owls and like deforestation, stuff like that.
Hoot.
It's called... Hoot.
No, that's not what they chose for Florida.
Oh, that's a shame.
They chose Spring Breakers.
Nice. Even better.
That's such a weird choice.
That might be the only Harmony Korine movie I actually like.
Well, I mean, Franco's amazing in it.
He's
unbelievable.
The Jets are on.
He's unbelievable in it. But I don't know if I would choose that as the movie to represent Florida. I don't know. That seems a little strange. So, all right. What do we got for Georgia? Oh, well, of course. Of course, Gone with the Wind. That's got to be. You know, you can't not choose that. Yeah. It's the highest grossing motion picture in history, if you adjust for inflation. Still the biggest movie. Highest grossing movie of all time. And it's so, you know, it's so attached to Atlanta that you can't. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Georgia, Gone with the Wind. Correct choice. All right. How about Hawaii? Although there are a significant number of movies that are set in Hawaii, almost none of them deal with what life is actually like there. This is because popular Hawaii-based films like 50 First Dates, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Punch Drunk Love treat the island as a generic vacation setting. That's why they chose Lilo and Stitch, which is a movie that I love.
Oh, it's adorable.
I love it. But I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, right? Punch Drunk Love doesn't take place only in Hawaii, though.
Mm.
So. All right, what about this? Idaho.
I mean, it's obvious.
My Own Private Idaho.
Yeah.
Which might be my favorite Gus Van Sant movie.
It's probably his best one.
Yeah.
You know, I know everybody loves Good Will Hunting.
I like Good Will Hunting. I don't love it. I like it. I like the one with Nicole Kidman and Joaquin Phoenix. Oh, man. To Die For. She's phenomenal in that movie.
You could say she's To Die For.
Yeah. She's great in it.
I like Elephant.
You do?
I do.
I'm kind of mixed on Elephant. What about the one with the it's supposed to be Kurt Cobain? He's just wandering around in the woods for an hour and a half.
Oh, God. I'm not sure.
I can't remember what the title of it is.
But yeah, My Own Private Idaho is
My Own Private pristine. Idaho is phenomenal. Yeah. All right, Illinois, here we go. Here it is. What? The Breakfast Club.
Poor choice. I don't know if that's I would like to hear the rationale for that.
Well, here's what they say. Hollywood has produced good to great movies with the inner lives of American teenagers for decades, but as good as films like Rebel Without a Cause, Last Summer, and American Graffiti are, they all fail capturing one essential aspect of being a teenager, all the boredom. Of course, a person's teen years can be filled with tragedy, violence, and intoxicating infatuation, but it's largely a stage of life defined by tedium. You're old enough to want to start your adult life, but you don't have the maturity legal standing to do so. But since doing a whole lot of nothing isn't dramatically compelling, most Hollywood teen movies just ignore that reality. However, that all changed with the release of John Hughes' Breakfast Club. The writer-director proved his bona fides as a premier teen dramatist with 16 Candles, but like earlier Hollywood teen movies, that movie had an element of aspirational fantasy. Conversely, The Breakfast Club is almost devastatingly realistic. It chronicles unusually eventful high school detention session in the small town of Shermer, Illinois. In the film, a group of five teenagers representing various teen archetypes spend detention getting to know each other a little better. In doing so, they develop a new empathy for one another and learn to be slightly less self-absorbed, but none of them pretend to be that their bonding session is life-changing. When they leave the detention, they'll still be the same people that they were before, and they'll all be bored to tears in class on Monday. Although very much a product of its time, the way The Breakfast Club captures the dullness and of adolescence makes it a timeless American movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that represents Illinois.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that it could be, that could be most high schools in the Midwest.
Well, I mean, I love The Breakfast Club.
Sure, yeah.
I adore that movie.
It's neither here nor there.
Absolutely love it, but I don't think it represents. I mean, wouldn't somebody just Blues Brothers?
Yeah. In terms of iconic imagery about
the state, yeah. And it's not just Chicago, it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been the first one that popped into my mind. I'm not crazy about the Blues Brothers, but that would have been the first one that popped into my mind to represent Illinois. Right? I remember when they shot that movie here. Mayor Byrne just gave him the keys to the town. They just do whatever you want. Do whatever you want.
Which is not something you want to do with John Belushi.
No, there's a fantastic picture of Aykroyd and Belushi. And Mayor Byrne and Jane Byrne, and they're all smoking. They just got cigarettes. You don't see a lot of mayors walking around with cigarettes hanging out of their mouths nowadays.
Nope, no.
Yeah, she gave them free rein. They got to do whatever the hell they wanted to do. I mean, Landis, I've had John Landis on the show, and he talks about how insane it was. And at that time, you know, they shot that movie in the summer of 1979. You know, when the number one album in the country was the Blues Brothers album, the number one movie in the country was Animal House, and the number one TV show was SNL, and John Belushi was on all of them. And he just, he partied. They didn't sleep a lot when they were making that movie, I can tell you that.
Can't imagine.
Yeah. Free reign in the summer of 1979. Do whatever you want to do to the city. Smash up any kind of, you want to, how many police cars do you want to smash up? Go ahead. I don't care. You want to drive through the Daily Plaza through the window? Go ahead. It's fine. Absolute insanity. And, of course, a cameo by Steven Spielberg. So, all right. Let's take a break here for some weather, right? Yeah. So, today, partly sunny, hot, humid, afternoon highs in the lower 90s. Heat index says could approach 100 degrees. For tomorrow, high temperature in the low 90s, heat index in the upper 90s, partly cloudy overnight. For Wednesday, not quite as warm with scattered thunderstorms, highs in the mid to upper 80s, warm and muggy with a chance of showers overnight. For Thursday, a little change from Wednesday, very warm and humid, a good chance of thunderstorms and highs in the upper 80s. And for Friday, warm, humid, chance of scattered thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs in the upper 80s, partly cloudy overnight. It's currently 70 degrees at O'Hare, 71 at Midway, 72 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll jump back into the states and the movies that represent them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. She complicated, left me anew to ride. She complicated. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio on the 18th floor here on downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Oh, it's July 1st, so rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. Rabbit, 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 everybody. There we go. First of the month, rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. Hey, by the way, I haven't mentioned this on the air, but I told you off the air. My future ex-wife knocked it out of the park last night on Perpetual Grace.
Oh, very excited to get home and watch.
Oh, she's so good. Yeah. You know, she's been only in bits and pieces so far, but like the first 20 minutes of the show is all Dana. It's all Dana. She's so good. She's got a filthy mouth. By the way, Dana DiLorenzo, who, is my future ex-wife. I love her. Terrific actress from Ash vs. Evil Dead. She's on this terrific show on Epix called Perpetual Grace, and she really got to shine last night. She really did. I was so happy. I texted her immediately afterwards. She texted me back, and I was like, thanks, because I was very kind. And the show, just in general, the show's great.
It's been getting rave reviews, really.
It's a great show.
It's a big one for Epix.
Yeah. Great, great show. Chicago and Stephen Conrad, the guy behind it. And Dane is great. She was so good. So anyway, we're talking about states that are represented by movies. And Illinois evidently is represented by The Breakfast Club. Let's see. 773 area code says The Great Outdoors for Wisconsin. That took place in Wisconsin. I don't even remember. Don't remember. I remember not liking it. That's the only thing I remember about that movie is I didn't like it. 304 area code says, would you say West Virginia was represented by Silence of the Lambs?
I don't know. Is West Virginia full of psychos that wear people's skin?
Yeah. 773 area code, Fargo for Minnesota.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'd be thrilled with it. 815 area code for the state of Maryland, I would suggest Tin Men. Yeah, well, you know, the Barry Levinson pretty much, almost all of his, well, at least all of the movies that he's a Baltimore guy. Like, all of his movies take place in Baltimore, most of them. Because you got Diner. He had the trilogy, Avalon. He didn't direct it, but he and Valerie Curtin wrote And Justice for All. That takes place in Baltimore. 847 area code, Backdraft. Oh, for Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
815 area code says Adventures in Babysitting. another one from the 815 area code. What about The Fugitive or The Untouchables?
I'll throw down a vote for The Untouchables.
Yeah.
Get a lot of iconic imagery there.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, Indiana. This has got to be a, this has got to be an obvious one, right? Because it's got to be Hoosiers. Yeah,
yeah. Gene Hackman.
Although, Breaking Away. Breaking Away.
Yeah, Gene Hackman doesn't ride a bike in Hoosiers, so...
Breaking Away, man. Beautiful representative of Indiana. Okay, Iowa, what are we talking about here? I mean, do we even... I'm wearing a T-shirt.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed that.
I'm wearing a T-shirt. That. Field of Dreams. I didn't go.
No?
Dan went and he got me a shirt.
He got you a shirt, the Field of Dreams.
Yeah. He went out to the Field of Dreams and Dan Shigrew. And he got me. I was like, pick me up a T-shirt while you're there. So that I can lie to people and tell them that I went. I'd love to go, though. I love that movie. All right, Kansas. Wizard of Oz.
Naturally.
Yeah. although a lot of it doesn't take place, you know.
In Kansas.
In Kansas. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Toto. What about Kentucky? Oh, The Insider.
Ooh, 20 years old this year.
One of my favorite Michael Mann movies. Man, Russell Crowe is so good in that movie. And so is Pacino. There's not a whole lot of Pacino yelling in that one. But, let's see. Louisiana. Oh, When the Levees Broke, of course. The great documentary. Spike Lee. That's actually one of his best movies.
Agreed. I'm surprised they didn't go for The Waterboy, though.
Okay, Maine. Now, it could be any number of Stephen King adaptations, right? Because most of all take place in Maine, and they chose The Shawshank Redemption. Frank Darabont's The Shawshank Redemption has, over time, become one of the well-regarded American films of the 90s. People forget that movie bombed when it was released. It made no money. And I know that it was nominated for Best Picture, multiple nominations and stuff. But that movie bombed. And it wasn't until it started showing on cable every 5 minutes. Because you can't, you know, there was a period of time when The Shawshank Redemption was on every day on cable. And that's where it built up its reputation. That's where people started to discover it. And I know now it's considered an American classic. But I remember vividly seeing it in the theater, and it was like four people in the theater, and nobody was going to see it. So it was not the classic that it is now.
Mm-hmm.
That's
would
sure.
It be would it be a crime to say that I think that it's a little bit overrated?
No, it's not a crime to say that. I don't think it's as great as a lot of people do. I mean, I like it.
I think it's like that, and The Godfather are constantly vying for top of the IMDb 250 list. And I'm just like, you can't look me in the eyes and say that just Shawshank Redemption is better than The Godfather.
It's not.
It's not. It's just not.
It's not. I like it. I mean, I like Shawshank Redemption. And I know people who have there are people who really love that movie. Like, really, really love it. And my old producer, Dan Shigrew, it's his favorite movie of all time. Let's see. Maryland, they chose Barry Levinson's Avalon. It's about Russian Jewish immigrants living in 1940s Baltimore. Like the other films in the Baltimore, and all the movies that he made, it's a semi-autobiographical movie. I always found Avalon to be depressing. Like a truly depressing movie. Speaking of depressing movies, jeez, for Massachusetts, they chose Manchester by the Sea.
Aww.
Oh, man. I mean, I love that movie.
And but I think that's I think that is a good choice.
Oh.
Because, like, you could easily go for, like, a Boston gangster movie, you know, for The Town or something.
Yeah.
But I think I loved Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, I do too.
And I think it's an amazing drama.
It's just devastating, though. I mean, God.
Everybody's at the top of their game in that
movie. No, no. Look, I agreed. Agreed. It's beautifully made, beautifully written, incredibly well acted. But my God, is it depressing.
I think I've only seen it maybe twice. Because it's, and it has to be like just, months apart.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't, I mean, it's devastating. Man, oh man, I mean, I was a wreck after that movie. But that's going to represent Massachusetts. There you go. All right, let's break here. We got the news coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke in just a few minutes because it's Monday morning and that's what we do. Here till 5, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday. Shortened week for us here on the show because of the holiday.
For you.
Oh yeah,
I'll be here.
well, I'm off on the 4th, on Thursday the 4th, and I'm off also on Friday the 5th, for the 4th of July. But Brian Noonan will be filling in for me on Thursday morning and Friday morning, and I thank Brian for doing that. Now you're working all week.
Yeah, I'll be here.
Okay,
making sure he stays.
Hold out the fort.
Yeah, you know that Brian Noonan, he's a wily one.
He is. You got to watch every move.
Sneak up on you.
So, I got a birthday this weekend, too. I'm looking forward to that. Should be fun.
Unfortunately, your gift won't arrive before your actual birthday, but hopefully I'll have a little something for you when we get back.
Oh, that's not necessary.
Necessary? No, of course not.
Oh, all right. All right. Well, thank you. Let's see. We were talking about states and movies that represent each state. Michigan, what do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I'm blanking.
8 Mile.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Without question.
Mom's Spaghetti.
Yeah. oh, look at it. Minnesota, Fargo.
There it is. I mean, you have to. I mean, I literally cannot think of any other movies that are set in Minnesota that like have or like that heavily feature it that much.
Oh, yeah. Here's Marty on WGN. Hey, Marty.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Well, The Breakfast Club. Give me a break, okay, first of all. For Illinois, if I had to pick one, Running Scared, Billy Crystal, Gregory Hines.
Yeah.
Shot in Chicago and ends up in the State of Illinois building.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, yeah. You know, I haven't seen that movie in a long time. It's been a long time since I saw that one.
No, I got a question for you, though. It's a little debate we've had. I heard that Breakfast Club was shot at Maine North, the old Maine North High School. I was told that's not even the real library. That is a set.
It's a set.
That was built in the gym.
Yeah, it's a set. The set was built in their gymnasium. Yeah, and that's not their real library. Yep.
Incredible.
Yeah.
All right, Nick. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Settle the bet there.
Yeah. All right. Here's some more. Jim from Crestwood said Illinois should be Northside 777. Great movie. 219 area code says, I would have chosen The Descendants with George Clooney for Hawaii. Yeah.
And Bo Bridges.
Yeah. 224 area code says, Sting is set in Illinois. Yes, it is. 219 area code says, Illinois, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I was waiting for somebody to bring that thing up. Len says, Florida, Body Heat or Scarface? Scarface. Representing, I mean, Florida.
That's Miami.
Illinois, he says Halloween. Oh yeah. Even though Haddonfield's not a real place.
It's based off of Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Yep. But yeah, come on, man. 773 area code Louisiana, the 1981 movie Southern Comfort. Oh my God, do I love that movie. Walter Hill. That's one of my I love that movie. You've seen it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I made my way through a lot of Walter Hill in college.
Just a phenomenal movie. So good. I don't know if it's a good portrayal of Cajuns, but Mississippi, they go with in the heat of the night. I guess that makes sense, sure. That's another one I haven't seen in a long time. How about Missouri? Waiting for Guffman? What? I don't even remember that movie taking place anywhere.
Again, it's a state that I'm like, I mean, there's got to be movies that are set there. There are. Nothing comes to mind.
I just don't remember. I mean, I'm in the minority on this. I don't like the Christopher Guest movies. I don't like them. He just seems to hate the characters that he, I mean, there's just, I don't know. I just don't like them. I like Spinal Tap, obviously, but the Christopher Guest, and it's not like he doesn't have talented people because, you know, the cast of people are so funny. Very, very talented people. I don't like Waiting for Guffman at all. So I just don't even remember where it took place. Montana, the Cowboys. There's so many though in Montana. You know, I mean, how many westerns can we choose from? Bruce Dern is the only guy that Bruce Dern has been hated because he actually is one of the only people in movies that killed John Wayne. In a movie.
What movie did he kill John Wayne in?
The Cowboys.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen The Cowboys.
Bruce Dern has been... People... And there was a period of time where Bruce Dern was... Like, people hated him so much because he shot the Duke. You know? That's a pretty interesting thing to be known for. I mean, other than the fact that he's like a terrific actor in his own right. And he was in The Burbs. And that might be my favorite Bruce Dern performance of all time. Not Nebraska.
I like Nebraska.
I love Nebraska, but The Burbs, man. He's genius in that movie. Well, there go the brownies. Oh, man. Speaking of Nebraska, it's not Nebraska. They didn't choose Nebraska. Are you ready for what they chose?
What they choose?
Children of the Corn.
Malachi.
That is ridiculous. Ridiculous. You know Courtney Gaines? You familiar with Courtney Gaines?
Yeah.
All right, you know, obviously you remember him, Children of the Corn. Couldn't be a nicer guy. Could not be a nicer guy. He came to Flashback a couple of times. And he's just a really, really cool dude. Really, really cool. So, yeah, Nebraska, they picked Children of the Corn. They couldn't have picked, Witness. Why didn't they pick Witness? How about Deliverance? That takes place in Nebraska. That's a real treat.
Yeah. I always thought Deliverance took place a little bit farther south, but no, it is Nebraska.
It is Nebraska. Let's see. Nevada. Ocean's 11, the remake, not even the one with Frank.
I'm definitely okay with that.
No, Nevada? Lost in America.
Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh. Yeah. Lost in America is just the portrayal of Vegas in that movie. I mean, I can't even. Nice damn, huh? You want to go first or should I? One of my favorite lines in film history. All right, here's Ike on WGN. Hey, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
All right.
Okay. Of course, there's a lot of movies that represent New York, but of course, you and I both agree that the number one, of course, a number one, Alyssa's Escape from New York.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. But it wasn't filmed in New York. It was filmed in St. Louis.
Right.
But of course, John Carpenter really pulled it off, and he made a great movie. Of course, along with The Warriors, that also represents New York.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. All right, Ike,
absolutely.
Thanks. Take care.
No problem.
Yep. A lot of New York movies, though.
I would go Do the Right Thing.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Taxi Driver.
Shoot.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
To me, that's the quintessential New York movie, especially at that time.
Right. I mean, I feel like every decade you could choose one.
You could choose a decade.
That is New York in the 70s.
But, I mean, that to me is like the quintessential New York film. New Hampshire, by the way, they chose The Rules of Attraction. God, I hate that movie. I hate that movie. Ugh. Let's see. New Jersey. What do you got? What do you think?
It's Clerks.
Got to be Clerks, right?
Yeah. No, you can't do
it's
anything.
It's Clerks. Yeah. Of course it's Clerks. I mean, you can't.
it is straight up just the most New Jersey. I've been to New Jersey once.
Yeah.
And walking around, this was in like, I don't know, 2010. It still looked like it was the 1990s.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a loving way. I really do. I enjoyed my time in Jersey.
I've been there. And I would choose Clerks. All right, New Mexico. Ooh, Ace in the Hole.
Very good.
Which is my favorite Kirk Douglas performance and my favorite Billy Wilder movie.
Mm.
And Billy Wilder's made a lot of great movies.
Yeah, Ace in the Hole is a masterpiece.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. The fact that that movie. The fact that that movie got made in 1951 and has the ending that it has and the content, that's as dark and twisted and bitter a movie as you're ever going to see. With, like, one of the most despicable lead characters. Man. But I love that movie. The first time I saw it, it's under a different title, too. It also goes by The Big Carnival. And that's the first time I saw it. It was on cable in the middle of the morning, and it was called The Big Carnival when I saw it, and I was like, oh my God, how did Billy Wilder get away with this, man? And so Ace in the Hole represents New Mexico. I think that's a great choice, a really great choice. So, all right, why don't we break here for some weather. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come up and wrap up the show. We've got a few more states to get to. What movies represent what state? 312-981-7200. We got New York coming up next. And look, you know what it is? I won't leave you in suspense. It's The Godfather. I mean, that makes sense. Totally makes sense. Again, there are 9,000 movies that have taken place in New York.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro.
Ah! It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go.
Yeah. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, my dad's been telling jokes now on the show here for a long time, and it's Monday morning. Let's get him in here. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Doing great.
Good. How's Ma?
Doing good.
Good. All right, you got a joke.
Got a joke. Says a guy was selling avocado out of a cart outside of a Catholic church, and the priest was giving mass, and he hears avocados, avocados, avocados. So he goes outside and he sees the guy. He tells the guy, "You can't stay out here hollering like that. I'm giving mass in the church. You got to move your cart." So the guy left, and 10 minutes later, giving mass, and he hears avocados, avocados, avocados. He did this about 3 or 4 times, and finally the priest got angry, and he went out, pushed the cart over, and all the avocado went out in the street, and they were ruined. So he went back into the church, giving mass, and all of a sudden he hears, guacamole, guacamole, guacamole.
All right, all right, all right.
I just want to say that everybody, I'm looking at the cameras, everybody at the station laughed out loud at that one, Dad.
All right, Nick.
You killed with that one. All right, Dad. Thanks,
right,
buddy.
Take care.
Yeah. Guacamole.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
That's a good one, man. That's a good one. Feel free to tell that one. All right. Let's go state by state. North Carolina, you ready?
Hit me.
Blue Velvet.
Nice. Yeah. Perfect.
Lumberton. Even though Lumberton doesn't exist. Does Lumberton exist?
No, no, no.
Ooh, how about this one? North Dakota. Logan.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right, all right.
Ohio. Major League.
Just a bit outside.
Just a bit outside. Okay, that's Oklahoma. Oh, Bonnie and Clyde. Nice choice.
Very good.
See, we got some text here before we get to the rest of them. Let's see. Is Mystic Pizza in Rhode Island? If that's so, that's my choice. 214 area code says New Jersey, Broadway, Danny Rose. 502 area code says Kentucky should be Secretariat. 773 area code says Montana, River Runs Through It, or Legends of the Fall. 708, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Missouri, Three Billboards.
Very good.
Minnesota, Purple Rain. The crazy Chicago movie, The Beginning of the End, with giant grasshoppers attacking Chicago. Yeah, they're on the Prudential Building, in fact. Nevada, Wild at Heart.
Yep. Any chance for David Lynch to be on this list?
All right, how about this? On the official list, Oregon, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Okay, what about Pennsylvania? Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Rhode Island. Reversal.
Reversal of fortune.
Oh, man, Jeremy Irons. So good as Klaus von Bülow. I love that movie. South Carolina, The Patriot, with Mellie Gibson's. South Dakota, The Revenant. Tennessee.
Nashville.
Yeah. That's kind of a given. All right, Texas. Well, let's come. I hope it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. American Sniper.
Wow. The correct answer to that question is Slacker.
Yeah,
I'm gonna because well, it's a very specific subset of Texas.
I'd go Dazed. I'd go Dazed and Confused.
Just anything Linklater, really, because it's you can put in Everybody Wants Some if you want to.
Yeah, which is a woefully underrated movie. Utah, SLC Punk. I hate that movie.
You don't like SLC Punk?
I can't stand that movie.
That's great.
Oh, can't
Mr.
stand
Mr. Premium it. Rush over here.
Premium Rush rules. Vermont, Super Troopers.
Car Ramrod.
I got to tell you, I was really disappointed with that sequel.
They waited too long.
Yeah.
They waited too long. I think they're still funny guys.
No. Listen, Super Troopers is not my favorite movie of theirs. Beerfest is my favorite movie. Beerfest is hilarious. Beerfest
like
is
Beerfest.
Like, laugh out loud funny.
I even like the Slam and Salmon.
Yeah, and I like the horror movie that they did.
Oh, Club Dread?
Yeah. All right. Virginia, they chose Arlington Road. The conspiracy movie with Jeff Bridges and Tim Robbins and Joan Cusack.
Interesting.
Bridges is great in that movie.
Yeah.
That's a really good performance. I mean, well, he's great in everything. I just remember being completely freaked out by the end of that movie. I couldn't believe how it ended. I was like, are you kidding me? The guy who directed that movie, why am I blanking on his name? Mark Pellington. He has a penchant for making movies that have insane endings. Because he did The Mothman Prophecies. And The Mothman Prophecies,
God.
The ending of that movie is unbelievable.
I really love that movie. I almost refuse to watch it because it freaks me out a lot.
My ex-wife, Heather, she says it's the scariest movie she's ever seen in her life. It completely freaks her out.
So. That Mothman stuff, man.
All right, Washington. War Games.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, West Virginia. Night of the Hunter.
Scarier than Silence of the Lambs, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Wisconsin. What do we got for Wisconsin? Oh, The Straight Story.
Aw. David Lynch appearing twice on this
list. How about that, man? Yeah. Who would have thought that there was going to be... that David Lynch would release a Disney movie rated G. Who would have ever... And it's a beautiful movie.
It's so good.
And it's also very obviously David Lynch. Mm-hmm. Like, even though the material is completely different, it's rated G. There's no nudity, no violence or anything like that in it. But yet, it's got David Lynch written all over it. All right, Wyoming. And, oh, well, there you go. Unforgiven.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No other choice, if you ask me.
Yeah. Every time I watch that movie, and I've seen that movie, I don't know how many times I've seen it. Every single time when the kid comes back and is telling Clint Eastwood that they killed Morgan Freeman's character, and he takes that first slug of whiskey, I get the chills every single time. He just starts slowly drinking the whiskey, you know, been on the wagon for all these years, trying to get his life back together, doesn't want to kill anybody. When he starts drinking that whiskey, I'm like, he's going to kill everyone in that town. Every single time I watch it, he is going to kill everybody in that town. It's my favorite Clint Eastwood movie.
It's probably his best, really.
Yeah, I think it's his best as a director, and I think it's best as his performance is amazing in it.
It just, you know, it upsets me because I do love Clint Eastwood. I know you love Clint Eastwood, and I just feel like he just cannot even get close to Unforgiven anymore.
Well,
like
he had a period of time, man, because he followed Unforgiven with A Perfect World, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, mm-hmm. and with an incredible performance by Kevin Costner, mm-hmm. And that kid. He had a stretch there where it was like, whoa.
Well,
like,
I know as a kid, Million Dollar Baby, people refused to stop talking about Million Dollar Baby. And I think that's a very good movie, but it's Unforgiven.
You
look at that movie for more than 15 minutes and you're like, yeah, this is about as good as his
powers
as a director is going to get.
Yeah, no, I think it's the best movie he's ever made. There's no question about it. But he's made a lot of great movies. And I happen to be like I happen to be a ridiculous Clint Eastwood fan.
It's true.
As we were going back through my top 10 list from the past, every Clint Eastwood movie in the past 10 years
yeah.
was on the list.
Where do you stand on those Dirty Harry sequels?
I love them. Love them.
Even the one with Jim Carrey?
Even the one with Deadpool. Jim Carrey? The Deadpool, love it. The chase scene with the little car?
Oh, my God.
It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Well, you know, the only reason he made that was so he could make Bird.
That was
when he was making movies for Warner Brothers. He's like, I'll make one for you and one for me.
Yeah.
White Hunter Black Heart, he made that movie, which is a masterpiece, but he had to make The Rookie with Charlie Sheen. So, all right. All right, we're going to break here, and we got the news coming up at 5 o'clock, and what do we got tomorrow? What's going on?
It's that time of the month. Tom Appel.
Oh, Tom Appel.